and that's a review of the Columbia River Fishery Management Policy. This is a staff briefing, and we're going to have a panel.
Receive input on development of and management of fisheries and alternative gear development. Worked during the North of Falcon process. We worked with managers and constituents to shape and develop management plans for our fall and summer fisheries. We also held two North of Falcon meetings on the east side of the state, and this year planning on three meetings on the east side of the state. Test fisheries have shown that perch and beach seines can be effective for salmon and salmon harvest in the fall. A three-year release mortality study was complete and is still under review. Current ESA permit release mortality rates significantly higher than anticipated for salmon. Anticipated 5%. Right now it's between 21 and 33% for Chinook and 29 and 38% for coho. That's our that's the numbers that we're working with under our ESA permit from NOAA. We're continuing to work with our co-managers and NOAA on release mortality. Oregon conducted a research below Bonneville Dam this year using beach seines and purse seines and comparing the catches to the gillnet catch, looking at the stock composition. The key to this was, is there more lower river destined fish in the seine fishery than there is in the gillnet fishery? We've collected coda wire tags and DNA from the study. The only thing we've got back is coda wire tags, and initial indications are that that the number of lower river stock in this fishery is extremely low and very similar to what we've seen in the last 20 years in the gillnet harvest. We're still waiting for the DNA to be worked up on this. Probably won't happen until sometime later this year. The pilot commercial seine fishery was conducted in 2014 and 15 with mixed results and participation in 2015. Steelhead handle can be relatively high, and not all beaches work well for beach seines. Seines fish in the summer handle moderate numbers of Chinook, but steelhead sockeye handle is high, and we have very low ESA number for sockeye, so difficult to use for those. Coho tangle nets were evaluated in 2009 to 2011 and showed promise for marked selective fishery. Full fleet fisheries were implemented in 2013 through 15 with a structure very similar to spring Chinook seasons with live capture regulations in place. Three-year mortality rate study was completed in 2015. Analysis of post-release mortality is ongoing. Our ESA permit includes a high interim mortality rate, which is about 30%, and mortality rates will replace interim rates when the study is completed. Other gear types reviewed or under investigation include ocean commercial troll gear, which had low catch rates, pound net, which had negligible catch rates, fish wheel, planning stages, but the big problem is securing permits in the gorge area, which is where they need to be operated. Floating fish trap had low catch rates and it was inconclusive. And an arrow net had limited field testing and is also inconclusive. Okay, Deep River Spring Chinook releases of 350,000 were discontinued in 2014. And we're continuing to investigate Cathlamet Channel as a new spring Chinook select area. The first adults return this year. We'll have a return of 4-year-olds this year. Spring Chinook Smolts released from net pens include $200,000 in 2014, $142,000 in 2015, and about $114,000 planned for this year. This year we've ran into some disease problems, so we've had some losses. That's why the number is lower. Deep River planned releases in 2016 include 1 million coho and 1 million Tule Falls Chinook. The Oregon Select Area plans expand season opportunities, provide additional hatchery fish for lease by shifting current production or providing new production. The enhanced production is generally on track for 2014 through 15, 2016 on track for coho and spring chinook, but fall chinook is going to be short. They had low escapement numbers for their select area bright, so that became that's going to be a problem for them. They're expanded, looking at expanding area boundaries. The research is ongoing since 2011, and looking at establishing new select area sites. This was started in 2014. They're looking at Clifton Channel, Westport Slough, Cold Creek Slough, and Bradbury Slough. One of those is three in Oregon, one in Washington. Gillnet buyback. We are coordinating with Oregon Fish and Wildlife and the industry to evaluate interest, interest in the buyback program. We've discussed investing in a coordinated survey with Oregon. Individual interest on buyback is going to be much more clear once we've moved through the transition period. Funding sources would need to be identified after development of buyback program. And Oregon legislation transfers commercial support programs to the counties. And the previous buyback were been funded by the federal government, and it reduced the Washington Columbia River permits by over half, and that was in the 70s and 90s. Barbless hooks were required to aid in the safe release of wild chinook. Oregon rejected proposals to allow barbed hooks in the Willamette and select areas. Washington has approved some exceptions in the lower river, some of the lower tributaries, when there was lots of hatchery fish to be caught and not a lot of wild or listed fish around to be intercepted. To increase management certainty, the department continues to work on securing funds to support fishery monitoring, data collection, and analysis. Working on improving pre-season forecasts and in-season run size updates, ongoing and TAC reviews, improve in-season tracking of ESA impacts of each fishery. The ocean model has been recalibrated and look to improve its effectiveness. There we are. Commissions track and implementation through annual reviews if policy expectations are not achieved. Determine causes and identify action to a correct course and make adjustments needed to stay on track. And I should say, for the people who can't see the screen, I'm talking about adaptive management right now. It needs to be a cohesive package. The key elements and principles of the plan would need to remain intact. Continuing on with adaptive management, reconsideration of state-managed mainstem fisheries may take place under the following circumstances: lower than anticipated catch and economic expectations to the commercial industry, insufficient space and off-channel sites to accommodate the commercial fleet, biological, fiscal, and or legal circumstances that delay or preclude implementation of alternative gear, buyback of commercial permits, and or additional off-channel hatchery investments. Management objectives are not achieved for sport or commercial fisheries. Conflicts with the terms of the USV Oregon Management Agreement with Columbia River tribes and failure to meet conservation objectives. And now we're going to turn it over to Robin.
Good morning. I'm Robin Elke, Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'm going to walk you through the 2015 season for Columbia River fisheries. When we manage these fisheries, we pretty much do it through the Columbia River Compact. We work with Oregon. We co-manage those fisheries when we're in those concurrent waters of the Columbia River, which is upstream to the Oregon-Washington border, which is just upstream of McNary Dam. We meet almost weekly, it seems like, earlier in the presentation, they mentioned that the compact met like 49 times, which, considering there's 52 weeks in the year, we're actively managing these fisheries. It's not the type of fishery that you set a season and come back to a month later and say, how did it turn out? So it's a pretty intensive process to manage these fisheries. Again, we work with Oregon. We work with the Columbia River tribes. And we manage on a three-tier process. We look at our our ESA limits that NOAA provides for us. We work under the U.S. Oregon Management Agreement that deals with the tribes and the non-Indian fisheries. Then, of course, we work within the guidelines set forth by the policy you've given us. So we'll start with the 2015 spring season. We had an upriver spring Chinook forecast of 232,000 fish. That gave us about a 2% ESA limit. The policy calls for us to buffer that, so that brings the allowable limit down to even something less at 1.9. As we moved through the season, by the time we got to the end of it, our actual return was greater. It was 289,000 fish. That gave us an ESA limit of 2.2%, so the number of fish available increased as the run size increased. The ESA impacts that are allocated to the non-Indian fisheries, the commission guides us to share those 70% sport and 30% commercial. For the lower Columbia River sport fishery, we're open for 74 days after 107 possible days. We were open from March 1 through the 15th, and we had 11 days in April. Those April days are very popular and very productive for our recreational fishermen. We had one day open on April 16th where we counted 2,000 boats on the river. That's not including the bank anglers. We had a catch that day of about 2,500 fish kept. So pretty powerful fishery, very popular, and fantastic fish, of course. For the Zone 6 season, that Zone 6 is Bonneville, technically up to McNary Dam, but we have increased that geographic area so that it also includes the area from McNary Dam up to the Oregon-Washington border. So it's been extended since about 2011 to provide additional opportunity. That fishery opens on March 16th, like it normally does. We were able to get through May 10th. We did extend that season by about 4 days prior to our run size update, which gave the fishermen more opportunity immediately, or I guess we didn't have to close it on the 6th like we had scheduled it. We had 4 more extra days there. And then we also have a Snake River sport fishery that we share the ESA impacts with. They opened in April. They have 4 different areas that they fish in. They usually fish like 3 days a week, so the season structure and timing of that fishery was about typical as what we've seen in past years. They closed in May, again, staggered closures, dependent on where the fish are geographically as they moved up the Snake River system. We were able to reopen that fishery in June. We opened it in June 1, and it actually was able to remain open until June 30th, which is the end of the spring season. That season was open 7 of the 11 weeks possible. We did implement the adaptive management clause that's in the policy. Staff is very grateful for that. It gives us flexibility to provide access to the different fisheries as we move through the seasons. We transferred some fish from the Lower River Sport Fishery to the Snake Lake River fishery so that it could reopen sooner on that June 1 day. We also, when I move into the commercial fisheries, we also implemented adaptive management there as well. In the spring seasons, you can see that we had an increase in the run size when we will close our fisheries until we get our run size update, and then we'll reopen them if possible. We usually do that in late May, and you can see from the Lower River Sport, well, actually from all three of those sport fisheries, that we did have reopenings in May and June, and with those later June openings, we were also able to increase the bag limit. So that increase in run size and the increase in the ESA limits provided opportunity beyond what was originally forecast. Go ahead.
We also had, in addition to these Columbia River fisheries you mentioned, we also had a fishery on the Yakima River for spring salmon this year, and also a very brief season on the Grand Rhone, another pilot. So we're seeing expanded fisheries based on our escapements, too, in those areas. Only due to water temperatures, we did not have a spring salmon season on the Wenatchee River, but we have had seasons now available in the Upper Columbia on spring salmon. And also, we're reaching escapement goals on the Methow River, too. So we're seeing good progress on the expansion of spring salmon opportunities.
All very positive things. So still in the spring season, then, for our commercial fisheries, we had eight periods. We started our first fishery on March 31. We had additional fisheries as the season continued. Our last fishing period was on the 11th of those eight periods. The total hours fished was 91 hours. We used tangle nets early in the season. That's what the policy calls for. That's a smaller mesh gear. It has a lower mortality rate. We used those through May, but similar to the past couple years, we've implemented, again, adaptive management, and we've moved into that large mesh gear in that May time period when shad abundance is pretty high, and we don't want to handle the salmon for any longer than that 45-minute time frame. Handling those salmon a little bit longer may increase mortality, so to avoid that, we've implemented the larger mesh gear. Let's see, what else did we do? Oh, we, at the end of the season, again, we had our sport fisheries open. We've increased the bag limit. We have a run size that was greater than forecast, and we also have ESA impacts that now have moved into a higher threshold. So we went from 2% up to 2.2%. And so one of our last fishing periods, we recognized that as a whole, the non-Indian fisheries would have a balance of ESA impacts remaining, and that there were fish under our catch balance provisions that would remain. So with that knowledge and with minimal risk, we were able to transfer some of the balance of the ESA impacts to the main stem commercial fishery so that it could access its catch balance allotment of upriver fish. And so at the very end of the season, we did have a fishing period where we transferred ESA to the commercial fisheries under the adaptive management clause. For our select areas, we had a good year in the select areas. They say it was the best since 2010. As we move through the season in the select areas, we are limited still on the ESA allocation to that specific area. We have to pull back some fisheries early on because that fishery is buffered as well until we get an in-season update. The river conditions this year with the warmer water conditions and just overall environmental conditions pushed some of the upriver fish more into the select areas, so we had to modify those fisheries while we were in season to make sure that it stayed within its own little allocation of the just for the select areas. So for spring season results, it's a pretty busy table there. It's just commercial and sport fisheries, just kind of outlining the things that we have to manage for as we move through the season. We'd have a catch balance limit that is provided through the U.S. Oregon Management Agreement, and then we also have ESA impacts that are limited through NOAA that the Commission tells us how to share them. When we conduct our fisheries, it's usually the commercial fisheries are limited by the ESA impacts. They're more constrained by that, where the sport fisheries are more constrained by the overall catch balance number. So each type of fishery is constrained by different factors. The bottom line for 2015 for this spring Chinook season is that we were well within our non-Indian ESA limit of 2.2%. We came in at 1.9, which is about 85% of allowed. And then also with our catch balance limit, which is from the U.S. v. Oregon policy, we were about 83% of allowed. Usually when we have a tick up in our ESA impacts, it's a little hard to catch up then with our fisheries. But again, coming in at 83 and 85%, that's a comfortable number. We had our fisheries pretty much as much opportunity as we could provide as we moved through, knowing what we did as we went through the end season.
Sorry for the interruption. I just want to, we got a lot of detail here. I want to make sure that people in the audience know that all of this is captured in our Columbia River Review report that's on the Commission website. So if you can't see the screen and it takes a little longer to digest this, so you can find it in that report, which is available for everybody.
And so then on this table, I would just also add that as you compare what was allowed post to what was allowed actual, keep in mind that we did implement adaptive management, which does shift things so that overall we can get access to the total non-Indian allocations. The next slide looks at all the different fisheries in the spring and how we came in, if you will, in our actual catch compared to what's allocated to each individual fishery, the Lower River Sport, the Zone 6 Sport, Snake River, and commercial fisheries. For the most part, for the 6 years that we've had the catch balance clause in the management agreement, the sport fisheries, we've averaged about 96% access to what was allocated to them. And for the commercial, the average is about 78%. They've actual compared to allocated. For our summer season, our Upper Columbia Summer Chinook, our forecast was 73,000 fish. Our actual return was a record return of almost 127,000. I think it's a record since at least 1960, so it was very nice to see that strong return of Upper Columbia Summer Chinook. The fisheries upstream of Priest Rapids Dam under the Upper Columbia Management Agreement is allocated a portion of the harvestable fish that are assigned to non-Indian fisheries through the U.S. v. Oregon Management Agreement. That ranges from 66 to 60%, dependent on the run strength. The lower the run, the greater the allocation to fisheries upstream of Priest Rapids Dam. For the non-Indian fisheries downstream of Priest Rapids Dam, the Commission guides us to share those harvestable numbers, 70% sport, 30% commercial. Our sockeye forecast was about 395,000 fish. Our actual return, again, was a strong return of over 500,000, which was the third largest since at least 1980. On our sockeye, we have an ESA limit of 1%. Commission policy allocates that 70-30 sport commercial, and we were able to allow retention of sockeye in our fisheries beginning in the summer period. For our summer seasons in 2015, we had a Lower Columbia River sport fishery that was open June 16th through July 31, which is the entire summer season. from June 16th through July 2nd. It was a marked selective fishery with a two-fish bag, and then after that it went to a one-fish bag and non-marked selective. For the fishery from Bonneville Dam upstream to Priest Rapids Dam, again, that was open the entire season, June 16th through July 31. From the area from Bonneville Dam upstream to the state line, same season structure as the Lower River Sport, marked selective through July 2nd with the two-fish bag, and then switching to non-marked selective with the one-fish bag for the remainder of July. And then from the state line up to Priest Rapids Dam, open the entire season, marked selective with the two-fish bag. The sport fisheries upstream of Priest Rapids Dam were open the entire season, July 1 through August 31, marked selective with a two-fish bag. Our commercial season, which is downstream of Bonneville Dam, we had three fishing periods. They were 8 to 12 hours each. And in the summer season, there is a select area fishery in Young's Bay, and they're targeting those early returning fall Chinook. And then we also have tribal fisheries in the upper Columbia, both Wanapum tribe and the Colville tribes. And then another aspect of the summer harvestable allocation are ocean fisheries. So that's part of the non-Indian allocation. And the next slide, again, is a busy slide. It's just the results of our 2015 season. As the run increased, just like the spring, the harvestable number of fish available increased. The sharing between above and below Priest Rapids increased. Well, I guess it would be decreased for above Priest Rapids Dam. It went from 66% when we started. It caps out at a 60% minimum for above Priest Rapids. Just looking at the bottom line, we were well within our harvest guidelines set forward by the USV Oregon policy, the Upper Columbia Management Agreement and Commission policy. Below Priest Rapids Dam, our fisheries accessed 80% of allocated, and above Priest Rapids Dam, which includes the sport and tribal fisheries, they accessed 76% of the allocation. For our fall season, we had a preseason forecast of fall Chinook at the Columbia River mouth of about 925,000 fish. Within that was about 520,000 upriver bright stock. The ESA impacts allocated through commission policy is no more than 70% of the URBs and LRH to the sport fisheries. Our preseason planning, we do this through the North of Falcon process, 55% of the upriver bright impacts and 70% of the lower river hatchery impacts were allocated to the sport fisheries. Postseason, the actual fall Chinook return, it's not final yet, but it's probably somewhere around 1.4 million, which is fantastic. For coho, we had a preseason forecast of nearly 540,000 fish. Our actual estimate, much less than forecast. I'm not sure if we're going to get 100,000, which is very low. The fisheries that we operate under were constrained by our ESA limits for both those Lower River Wild Tule Fall Chinook and the Lower Columbia Natural Coho. And this year I'd also have to say that they were constrained by Snake River Steelhead ESA impacts as well. The fishery season objectives, at least, were met for all fisheries with the exception of the lower rivers, with the exception of the Buoy 10 fishery. We had to shorten that season by a bit. It was a fantastic fishery overall, but the season length did not quite make it to that Labor Day objective. Our preliminary actual sharing, again, nothing's final yet, but postseason, it looks like 59% of the upriver brights and 70% of the LRH were accessed by the sport fishery, which is within the commission guidelines. So for the 2015 fall fishery for our sport, again, buoy 10, we had about 108,000 angler trips. Our Chinook catch was about 36,000 fish. That ranked the second highest, which was more than we assumed preseason, mainly because of the increase in the run size. Our coho catch, we had about 37,000 fish caught, which was high despite that low return I just mentioned. And then the allocated ESA impacts on lower Columbia River tules was probably more than we had assigned preseason. Not to say that we went over on our impacts in general for the non-Indian fisheries, but for that one fishery, the number of impacts we allocated to that was likely greater than preseason. For our lower river sport fishery, we had 131,000 angler trips. The Chinook catch was about 41,000. That ranked the highest in recent history and more than we had anticipated preseason. Our coho catch was about 1,000 fish. That's about average for that fishery. And our allocated ESA impacts for those lower Columbia River tules was likely similar to what we had assigned preseason. For the Zone 6 sport fishery, that's a full season. We estimate about 13,000 Chinook caught, and again, likely more than preseason due to the increase in the run size. For the commercial fisheries during our fall season, those fisheries occur from August through October, mainly in Zone 4-5. We did have one Chinook-directed fishery in all zones, Zones 1 through 5. The Chinook catch totaled about 77,000 fish, which is about what we anticipated preseason. And then the allocated impacts on those lower river tules was likely similar to preseason as well. So despite the increased run, the actual numbers came out to be about what we anticipated preseason. For the coho fisheries, those occur in October in zones 1 through 3. We didn't get a lot of coho time on the river this year in response to that low coho return. We only had 5 fishing periods. 3 were with tangle net gear. Those are our Mark Selective fisheries for coho. 2 were with the standard 6-inch gear. 3,000 coho is our catch for the coho-directed fisheries, which I don't know when the last time was it was that low. For our select areas, it was pretty much a standard season. There were some slight modification. Landings in the select areas were also less than average. The Chinook catch was the lowest since 2009, and the coho catch was 41% of average. So those select areas in the fall didn't do very well.
What about the effort that was seen? Is that the commercial effort in the fall, is that at all related to the lower than expected catches?
I think the effort we gauge by number of deliveries. I don't think that they were anything less than what would be average. I think what a lot of the less than expected given the large run could fall into still being constrained by those lower river tules, and there was some constraints at the end of the season due to steelhead. So it was more an ESA constraint than an effort issue. So the seine fisheries, we had a seine fishery in 2015. It was a lot like what we conducted in 2014. We had the same amount of permits available. We had about the same amount of fish available. It was a 23-day season. We had 2 draw periods to issue those permits. Again, there were 6 beach and 4 purse seine permits available. Open enrollment period, whatever you want to call it, they could apply for a permit anytime they wanted through the season. It never closed, so the permits were always available if the fishermen chose to apply for them. We had individual fish quotas assigned to each permit. We had three beach and three purse seines operating in 2015. Landings were about 3,000 Chinook and about 1,000 Coho. I think if all the permits were issued and filled, it would have been somewhere around 4,000, 6,000 Chinook and I forget how many Coho. A couple thousand Coho, but so there were permits that were unused. The permits that we did issue, some were filled and some weren't filled, meaning they accessed the number of fish allowed under each permit. It was mixed results for the permittees. Some of the good news is we had some fishermen out there that had done it last year. They were experienced. They knew what they were doing. They had already invested in the gear. They were ready to fish. And as expected, we also had fishermen that were inexperienced and were willing to try it. And they put forth a good effort. One of the benefits of this year, I think, was we did see where some of the inexperienced fishermen worked more closely with the experienced fishermen in a co-op sense, if you will. So there was experience being gained, and some of the newer guys were learning a lot from the people that were out there doing it, so it was beneficial in that way. The reasons perhaps why maybe we didn't fill all the permits or why interest was lagging, high startup costs, that's something that we've identified even the year before. The salmon have low mark rates. It's a mark selective fishery. And then especially with the beach seines, there's some conflict in geographic area, for those beaches. So those were some of the issues that our fishermen are sharing with us that they're trying to overcome as we introduce these pilot fisheries. Moving on to the 2015 economic measures, one of our guiding principles tells us that we need to enhance the overall economic well-being and stability of these Columbia River fisheries. We gauge that by looking at the angler trips in the recreational fishery and the ex-vessel value for the fish that are sold through the commercial fishery. You can expand either one of those measures to account for the full contribution, and then each one of those measures have issues, little caveats that affect them that we can't control, how big the run is, how well the river held up as we were fishing, what the river conditions were, what the mark rates were, so there's other things on the outside that can affect both our angler trips and our ex-vessel values. So for 2015... the angler trips, this is pretty much for just below Bonneville Dam. The total angler trips was the second highest we've seen since 1982. The total Chinook catch of nearly 103,000 fish was the highest we'd seen since 1982, so a good year in 2015 for angler trips. We do obviously have fisheries upstream of Bonneville Dam. The additional angler trips there would increase the values. We don't have those for all of them, but for instance, Hanford Reach would add probably another 50,000, and the Upper Columbia summer sport fishery is also very popular, so angler trips from that fishery would increase the numbers presented here. When we look at 2015 for these angler trips and compare it to the past couple of years, 2015 was 98% of what we saw last year and 119% of what we saw in 2013. Angler trips are holding steady. For the commercial fisheries, we look at the ex-vessel value. This includes both the main stem and the select areas. Our total Chinook catch was the second highest since 1989, mainly due to those high record Chinook returns in the summer and the fall. Our coho was the lowest since 1993 because of that low return year. The main stem fishery accounts for 65% of the Chinook and coho catch, and the main stem fall Chinook was 52% of the total. And so that is our zone 4-5 fishery in the fall upstream of the Lewis. That fishery in itself is more than half of what the commercial fishermen bring in for the whole year. And then our sand fisheries, the value this year was about 57,000 fish. Just doing the same comparisons, when you look at 2015 ex-vessel, it's 80% of 2014 and 93% of 2013. So for our 2015 policy performance, our 2000 fisheries, we were within our ESA limits provided by the federal government. We were within the USV Oregon Management Agreement, which is our agreement between the Columbia River Treaty Tribes and other parties to the USV Oregon, and within the commission guidelines. So those are the tiers that we manage our fisheries to remain within. We did enact some of the adaptive management protocols, certainly in the spring season, so we could gain access to available fish. Our season objectives were met with the exception of Buoy 10, but Buoy 10 was a fantastic fishery this year. I think most people would agree. We are continuing to use that tangle net gear for coho. That is a marked selective coho commercial fishery. Our same gear, again, implemented in 2015 during the fall season. Our research and development in the new select area sites continues, certainly in Washington and Oregon as well. And our public processes, those are in place to help ensure that we're transparent and that we gain all the input from the public. And so looking beyond this year, looking at 2016 and forward, for the spring of 2016, our ESA sharing is again going to be 70% sport, 30% commercial. The season should be similar to what we saw in 2015. And then part of the ESA sub-allocation on our sport fisheries is that we share those 75 upriver to lower river. For summer Chinook, for the above Priest Rapids Dam piece, that can be anywhere to 60% to 90% given whatever run size we're working with. And then the commission policy tells us to share the harvestable share downstream of Priest Rapids 70-30 sport for both Chinook and sockeye. Our seasons are developed through the North of Falcon process for both the fall and the summer. In the fall, the ESA is shared 70-30 sport for the Chinook, and we'll continue to implement those alternative gears in the fall season, and we'll continue to review those release mortality rates that are dependent on our alternative gears for the seine fisheries. One more. So our key outcomes for success, obviously, again, we meet those USV Oregon and other management protocols that remain within our ESA conservation limits. For our commercial fisheries, we want to make sure that the select area enhancement continue and result in increased harvest, that our alternative gear is successful, and that we are able to access additional hatchery salmon and assist in the conservation objectives. We want to gain access to any surplus upriver bright Chinook, and that's mainly that Zone 4-5 fall fishery, and then restore some access to the later returning coho, which is typically during the month of October. And for our sport fisheries, making sure that we increase the angler trips and meet our season objectives, and then maintain opportunity throughout the basin. And that concludes our report, and we'll be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Robin. Yeah. Guy, any questions from commission? Comments?
Sure, I am. When you look at angler trips, and that's kind of a measure of success of the of the policy, I see you presented data for 2013 through 2015. It seems to me, and maybe you've done this, but perhaps a more appropriate analysis would be to look at angler trips pre-implementation of the policy. And so just wanted to see if you've had a look at that, and how does that fare?
Commissioner Kehoe, we do have that information, and we have presented that in other forums, so it's readily available, and that's a good point, just to show the trend would be reflective of increased opportunity over a longer span.
Okay, but so I can get that information then? Okay. And then I guess, too, you know, you present some just raw numbers there. Have you done any statistical analysis to see if there's any, you know, there's random variation from year to year. Is there any statistical difference between the numbers in terms of angler participation, or is it pretty close?
I haven't ran it through a statistical program to, you know, say if it's significant. I think our anglers would say that if it's less, then it's significant. So,
understood.
Yeah.
But I guess just from a quantitative analytical perspective, and that's what we do a lot here on the commission, I mean, that would be, at least for me, would be informative. And then one last one, too. How much, you know, if there is, has been increase in angler trips, recently. How much, or are you able to tease out how much has to do with the policy versus how much has to do with increasing run sizes that we've enjoyed over the past few years?
Yeah, it would definitely have to be a combination. They will go hand in hand, but the shift of allocation also provides that additional harvest as well on even those bigger runs. And for the analysis, I'll just back up a bit. Just now getting 3 points of data, you know, since the policy was in place, so part of the function of that transition period is to allow us to get enough data points so that we can run some analysis that actually has some meat behind it, if you will. So that will be our goal for this upcoming year.
Okay.
Commissioner Kehoe, I might just add that I recall that we did do an analysis or a display of angler trips in the Lower Columbia River by decade, starting with the 80s and the 90s and then going into the 2000s and then 2010s. And that shows an interesting trend, which is upward. And I think, as Robin indicated, a lot of that is associated with increased run sizes here in the last 10 years, but also changes in allocation and, opportunity that has continued, and plus increased interest. A large increase in interest in fishing salmon on the Columbia River, and that kind of goes hand in hand with the increased run sizes.
Good presentation, a lot of data. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Brad?
Yes. Sure, Thorne.
I just need a clarification as we're looking at the evaluation of selective gear for the commercial fisheries. So this low mark rate in the pilot fall seine fishery, that's being evaluated in an Oregon study that's ongoing. Is that what you had said?
The low mark rate is inherent in the salmon stocks themselves. And so the fall Chinook in particular, there's a wild component in the Hanford Reach. And so those are wild fish, and they're not going to be ad-clipped. They're not hatchery fish. And so they contribute heavily to the overall fall Chinook return. So you're going to see that adipose fin clip rate be low, and there's not a lot we can do about that. And so what the fishermen were saying was that we're releasing a good portion of the fish, and so that was their comment on that. For what Oregon is doing in the study, they are looking at more of the stock composition as a whole, and so of the fish that we're encountering, where are those fish from, upper or lower river?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Again, thank you, Guy, Ron, and Robin.
Robin, Guy,
appreciate it. Before we go into the committees, I'd like to invite Representative Pike. We always provide the courtesy to our elected officials to address the commission when we are in their backyards. So, welcome, Representative.
morning, Commissioners, and I want to thank you, first of all, and just to identify myself, Liz Pike. I represent the mighty 18th Legislative District, which is only a few miles from where we're all sitting right here today. But first of all, I want to thank all of you for your commitment to the citizens of Washington State and all of our fishermen and women who enjoy a robust fishing industry here. I know all the sacrifices that you make and your families make for you to participate in this body. So my heartfelt thanks for all of the things that you do for our residents. Now I'm going to be very direct. This is wonderful to see all these folks behind me that are my bosses and also your bosses. And in the 18th Legislative District, which is entirely inside of Clark County, we have 13,000 folks. That's about 10% of my entire legislative district that purchase fishing licenses, and then another 10,000 Columbia River endorsements. That is a bunch of people. And if all those folks came here today to testify, you would have to rent the Clark County Fairgrounds to hold them all. So behind us, behind me, is a small slice of the folks that the policies that we make in the legislature and the policies that you guide on the commission affect all those folks. And that's just one legislative district out of 49. This last session in 2015, I introduced a piece of legislation called 1550, HB 1550. And it was the first, from my understanding, it was the first bill ever introduced that prioritized recreational fishing over commercial fishing in this state. And let me tell you what is the impetus behind that piece of legislation. And I'm sort of new at this legislative business. I'm only in my second term. So I've been in Olympia. This is my fourth year now. And I needed to get a better grasp on this antagonistic relationship between the commercials and the recreational fishermen in my part of the state. And I was getting, and I could almost set my watch by when fishing seasons opened here and the complaints would start coming in from my constituents about this interaction, this problem between these two user groups. And text messages, phone calls, emails to my legislative email from recreational fishing enthusiasts in my district that feel like they are not treated very fair by the current policy. And when you look at the total budget of DFW, 19% of DFW's budget comes from these people right here that are recreational fishing persons. And just one half of 1% comes from the commercial interests in this state. Think about that. If you're looking at a graph, 19% would be up here, and one half of 1% would be this big. So this user group deserves some respect because they are paying the full load to DFW's budget. Now, part of 1550 was to create a world-class fishery in Washington for the recreational market. Imagine instead of all those folks flying right over Washington State to Alaska to spend all their money, vacation money, travel money, hotel money, fishing license money. Imagine if we could capture more of those in the state of Washington. We could become the best recreational fishing industry in the world. People would come from all over the world if they had predictability and reliability with our seasons. And from my perspective, those are the things that could be improved with our Columbia River salmon policy. And it's not just the fishing licenses and the endorsements and the 19%. It's also the boats and the trailers and the tackle and all those things that get filled up in a cooler on a fishing boat. Because a day on the river, folks need some sustenance while they're waiting to catch their fish. So the economic impact beyond the 19% to DFW is phenomenal. It's incredible, and it could be so much more. And think about if we became a world-class recreational fishing destination, we could end up having so much more revenue coming into this state, not even counting the tourism dollars, but with this extra revenue from out-of-state fishermen and women contributing to our general fund, you could upgrade your current fish hatcheries and you could build more fish hatcheries to take care of all of that. So I don't want to take up all your time because the people behind me are far more important than I am, but I just want to, very directly encourage you to consider adopting some of the tenets of HB 1550 in your upcoming policy decisions. And the folks behind me, they only have two sets of people to help them achieve fairness. They have all of you, and they have me and my colleagues in the House and the Senate. And we all know the reality is bills like HB 1550 run into a big buzzsaw in the 19th Legislative District on the Ag and Natural Resources Committee. So that leaves only you folks, because our bills are never going to get out of that committee because of a variety of reasons that everybody behind me knows and all of you folks know. So I'm asking you to adopt policies that create a fair and equitable environment for our recreational fishermen and women in this state. And thank you again for your time today.
Thank you, Representative.
The chair has passed off the next items we're going to do here. Commissioner Kehoe and I got together, our heads together here a few weeks ago, and thought it would be more than appropriate to have a panel session here, a group of commercials, and then followed by a group of recreational representatives. So I'd like to call up the commercial panel, which is made up of Irene Martin, Bob Sudar, Jim Wells, and Greg Johnson. We intend to go 20 minutes at the most for each panel, and then we have to move along because we have quite a lot more on our schedule for today.
Do you have Tammy time it?
Yeah, Tammy?
Yes, sir.
Can you time the 20 minutes?
Good morning. My name is Irene Martin. I'm here to introduce the Salmon for All presentation regarding Columbia River Harvest Policy number 3620. 2015 completes the third year of the four-year transition period for the policy. Salmon for All has provided two previous annual reports to the Commission tracking the outcomes of policy implementation. As we enter the final year of the transition phase, several continuing issues should be of concern to the Commission regarding the policy's serious flaws. And today we plan to address the three most important issues. And those are that the economic goals and commitments are not being met, safe area production goals and returns have not been met, selective gear testing and implementation, except for the tangle net, has not proven successful in reducing mortality rates or harvesting large surpluses of fish that have occurred. The Department's 2016 supplemental operating budget request included $314,000 to fund, and now I quote the document, the production of 200,000 coho salmon at the Deep River Net Pen site and 250,000 spring Chinook salmon at the Cathlamet Net Pen site. The governor's budget, however, failed to include this request. As the department's supplemental budget noted, and again I'm quoting, failure to fund this request will result in the elimination of the Cathlamet net pens and no increase in the coho salmon production in the Deep River net pens. This will be inconsistent with the direction of the Columbia River Management Reform Initiative and may result in requests by commercial fishers to revisit the recreational commercial sharing guidelines. This is exactly the position we now find ourselves in. After 3 years of implementation, we do not yet have adequate numbers of Washington safe areas to fish in. There is no funding to raise the fish in the two available safe areas in Washington. Kathlamet Channel should get its first returns of spring Chinook this year, but we do not yet know if those returns will arrive and in what quantities. So we don't know even if it's going to be a successful site. The department's supplemental budget request stated that, again I quote, development and continuation of hatchery fish released in these off-channel areas is critical to offering commercially licensed fishers opportunity that targets harvestable hatchery adult salmon. It is our request that the Commission and the Department should do exactly what their supplemental budget suggested, and that is to revisit the recreational commercial fishing guidelines. It is impossible to overcome the serious problems of the last 3 years, which we have reported to you, and try and do it in the next, which is, or this coming year, which is the final transition year. The Commission made numerous policy commitments to us in Policy 3620. To produce robust and economically viable commercial fisheries, those commitments must be kept. And the following presentations will outline areas where the Commission's commitments either have not been kept or where key components of the policy have not worked as expected. I'm going to turn it over to Rob Sudar at this point.
Thank you, Commissioners. My name is Rob Sudar. I'm a small marketer from Longview. I deliver fish to fish markets, grocery stores, and restaurants. And some of those markets I've had for over 30 years. I'm going to present some graphs today that drawn from data from Washington, Oregon staff that show why the current Columbia River policy isn't meeting its intended goals. Salmon are a food fish in Washington. They're not a game fish, and they're owned by all citizens of the state. All residents contribute to the cost of salmon production. In this graph, the red line shows the population in Washington and its growth over the last 15 years. The blue line shows total angler license sales over that same period per year. The many, many people who eat a local salmon, who want to eat a local salmon for dinner but don't want to catch it themselves, look to the commercial industry to provide that fish for them. One of the goals of the policy was to increase angler trips by 15% over the first 4 years of the policy. After 3 years, as you can see right here, that the average isn't really any higher than the average of the 3 years preceding the policy. So there hasn't been that 15% growth. In addition, the total angler trips for the last 2 years, which were mentioned to be record, aren't really much larger than angler trips 15 years ago. The blue line on this graph is total angler trips. And the red line is average angler trips per day over the course of the season. That average hasn't grown, which shows that there may be a consistent group of anglers who are willing to fish when there's an opening, but there has been no new surge in angler participation. In order to fish on the Columbia, you need to have a fishing license and a Columbia River endorsement. This graph shows total fishing license sales in the state, and it also shows sales in Columbia River endorsements since their inception. And
Robert, excuse me, yes. We do have a question from a commissioner.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Excuse me. Back to your graph.
Previous one?
Yes, please.
Yep.
Are these Columbia River or are these basin-wide?
They're Columbia River below Bonneville because those are the numbers that were discussed most in the policy. So angler trips below Bonneville and average daily fishing below Bonneville.
Okay, because I'm from the upper end of the basin, and yeah, fishing trips up there are big.
Yeah.
In the spirit of your presentation of continuity, could the commission keep our questions until you guys are done?
Increased smolt production in the select areas was one of the promises of the policy. And this graph shows smolt production over the last 20 years, actually, in those select areas. The purple line is fall tule chinook, which are the most abundant releases. They're also the least valuable fish. The red line are coho production, and the blue and green are spring and summer Chinook, which are the most valuable fish. As you can see, the majority of the releases are in the Tule Fall Chinook and Coho. They haven't shown significant increases in the last 3 years of the policy. And in addition, the releases now aren't really any higher than they were in some previous years in those areas. This graph compares our main stem earnings to our select area earnings. The red line represents our main stem, which usually contributes 60 to 65% of the total earnings in our industry. And the blue line shows the select area contribution. The harvest in the select area is being maximized to catch as much as possible, except for what's required for egg take. So there's no room for that select harvest to grow to make up for that large amount that we're earning from the main stem fishery. And this graph is another way of looking at that same data. The red and blue, the column is the main stem fishery, the blue is Chinook, the red is our coho share of our income, and the purple and green is the select area harvest, the green is Chinook, and the purple is coho. Our main stem harvest consistently focuses on Chinook, the most valuable and most in-demand salmon in markets and restaurants. And coho are a major component in select area income. They also tend to be the least dependable fish for returning from year to year in the Columbia. So to summarize, salmon are food fish. They're owned by all residents of the state, and all residents contribute to the cost of salmon production. The vast majority of the population doesn't sport fish, so they look to a commercial fishery like ours to provide local salmon in markets and restaurants. The predicted growth in angler participation via the policy has not occurred, and the select area fisheries cannot grow enough to replace our main stem fisheries. Thank you very much.
Next speaker is Jim Wells.
Mr. Chair and Commissioners, Jim Wells from Astoria, commercial fisherman for my whole life, Salmon for All president organization. I'm going to cover some select area information for you. But first, I'd like to make a comment. Listen to the legislator that spoke about increased time and for the wreck fishery. If you look at the stats for the spring season, if you count February, which a lot of people do fish down in our area, recreational fishery had 102 days of fishing this year. It was open 102 days. Went into the summer season. It was a full six-week season, 7 days a week. It never closed. Both of those fisheries left fish on the table on the sport allocation. They were allocated more than they could catch. And when the wreck fishery opened May 15th, it never closed in the Columbia River. That fishery went seven days a week. It went into Buoy 10, and it went into the upriver all fall. It never closed. So you add up all those days, it's 260 days roughly. I don't know what else you guys can do. I really don't, to add days. It's pretty much full seasons. Everybody should be happy with that. So you guys should have a handout up there if she got it to you. We'll start with a pie chart. This is compiled by Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. All the figures I'm going to give you are from both departments. They can be vetted with staff. The first part of it shows our income. Robert talked about it on a slide. But it shows in dollars where our income is coming in our fishery, main stem, and selects. And if you go to the bottom, it shows it in a percentage. So on a three-year average, 13 to 15, 63% of our income is coming out of the main stem. And that's the problem right now with this policy is how is that income going to be made up when we're removed from the main stem? If you look at right at the bottom, I wrote it in, the 2015, if you just look at that alone, 69% from the main stem, 31% from selects in a dollar value. And that money needs to be made up somehow in this policy. Next one, if you look, it's a select area catches. I didn't try to cherry pick. I just grabbed 10 years, 2006 to 2015. Purpose of this is to show you guys how erratic the select areas are. You can look in 2010 on winter, spring, and summer. We had a banner year, almost 25,000 springers in there. But you can go clear back to where selects were instituted. You'll never see another year like that. That never happened. You go to 14, there was only about 4,600 caught. So it's very erratic. And in the coho, we had a huge year in 14 that bumped up our select area value. But look at the next year, like 15 below at 27,000, from 168 to 27,000 in 1 year. Very erratic in those fisheries, and really hard to count on. Can't just have that. At the bottom, something that a lot of people don't know, people talk about planting, you know, a million or a half a million smolts or 100,000 smolts. The percentages there are what the department's figure select area harvest will be off the releases. So you only get a half a tenth of a percent on spring Chinook. You get 0.3% on Sab fall Chinook. You put out 100,000 smolts on Sabs, you get a 300 fish harvest return. And that's averaged over a lot of years. That's state figures. A lot of smolts, very small catch. And so that's the problem. You can only raise so much fish. The third one, I'm just going to show you. You guys only had one select area going for a long time, and that was Deep River. I've got it circled there at the top. You can see all our production, winter, spring, and summer, and all our select areas down there. And then look at Deep River's contribution. It was absolutely terrible. A lot of money spent over there, a lot of money wasted. And so that was curtailed, and they decided they would try Cathlamet Channel. Problem with Cathlamet Channel, and it says right in your document, the test fishing data is similar to main stem test fishing data. And that's because there's all kinds of upriver fish in there. It's been a great drift for the Cathlamet guys for years, but it's full of upriver fish transiting through there. I'm telling you, as a fisherman, that's not going to work as a new select area. Neither is Clifton Channel in the Oregon side. It's the same problem. Too many upriver fish in there, too little impacts to fish and get your harvest. So if you want to put a half a million Springer smolts in there, you might get a return of, you know, 500-600 fish. Is that worth building all that infrastructure for that and not even have the impacts to run it to fish? It's a waste of money. Also, when you left Deep River in the spring of 2011, there was 320,000 smolts released into Deep River that year. Then you left, went to Cathlamet Channel, and in 14, that fell to 200,000. 15, 142. This year, they're looking at releasing 114,000 smolts for the whole thing. And it's a declining instead of going the other way. And Deep River fall in Tule's, when you left, or still active in the fall in Deep River. But in 2013, you released 2.6 million Tule impacts. And the new goal in there is a million and a million coho. And when you look at these return charts on, the page I gave you, it doesn't list the Tule. It's way below what those are. It's embarrassingly low. I didn't even put it on there. You got to put out millions of Tule smolts to get a return. And that's because they're heavily harvested in the ocean. They clear up to BC. The Canadian trawlers take a big whack of those fish. And when they come down, the ocean sport fishery gets them and the trawlers. And when they come in the river, buoy 10 depends on those fish. And then severe bird predation when those things out-migrate. Terrible. So you got to raise millions of those things and release them to make an economic difference to us. And when they come back, they're only 50 cent a pound fish, where a bright's worth 250. So the policy you guys passed for Willapa Bay with that immediate hatchery cut over there, I think it was 35% right out of the blocks. And your cuts in your hatchery steelhead on this side to go more to wild fish. It appears to us that you guys are going more into wild fish and less hatchery production. And this program calls for a lot of hatchery production and releases to mitigate our loss of the main stem, and I don't see that working out. I gave you a handout of Young's Bay. It's this one right here.
That's our best select area, best producer. It's a good aerial view of it at low tide. Follow it up around the corner up by the Waleski River. And that's what most of all of our select areas look like down there, is that part. And you can't get, we have a 250-fathom legal net length. You can't even get 100 fathoms across that little channel, which is 600 feet. And so that gives you a good idea of what we're fighting. And there's absolutely no room in these areas for all the boats that'll have to come in there when you take the main stem away, if you do. Okay. And the last one is this page here. And this is adult salmon annual totals over Bonneville. And if you look at the last 3 years, 13, 14, and I put in 15 on the top. This goes back to 1930. I didn't even copy the second page of it, but it goes back to 1938. And in 1938, there was 271,000 total Chinook over Bonneville. In 15, we had 1,000,003. You're going to see no years at all clear back to 38 that are anything like these years. They're huge records. And if you asked if we've been harmed, had we been fishing on these runs with the impacts we had before this Kitzhopper plan, and we would have been able to take advantage of these runs, that main stem pie chart would look a lot bigger in value than it does right now.
Jim, we have 2 minutes left if Greg would like to chime in.
I'll give it a shot. Hi, my name's Greg Johnson. I serve on various advisory groups. Welcome to Vancouver. During the development of the policy, one of the most concerning elements of the policy was the large degree to which it relied on assumptions as opposed to science. After 3 years, there are still more questions than answers. Importantly, there has been significant amount of discovery that needs to be further reviewed to be presented in a what we know, where do we go sort of document that both commissions can use to move this process forward. We are quickly approaching the long-term step in this policy. Relative to the expectations of the policy, there doesn't seem to be a clear path moving forward. Concerns relative to future seine fisheries. Chinook are 34% larger in seine fisheries. This is a significant decrease in revenue. Seine prices have averaged 20% less, a minimum of 17% reduction in the harvest of higher valued upriver bites. These three factors together represent a potential 50% reduction in the value of the main stem fishery. We welcome an analysis that will shed light on this matter. Operating costs. In our current fishery, for example, myself, last year I had a deckhand 3 different days. And in a seine fishery, you're going to need two or three deckhands at a cost of 25 to 30% off the top, as well as you're going to have to insure this because inevitably somebody can get hurt in these operations. That's a $5,000 to $3,000 cost. New investment. The state of Oregon conducted an analysis to determine the cost of the average fisher to gear up for per seine operation was $190,000. As a fisherman and a businessman, how can I make sense of investing this kind of capital in a fishery that may show a net return of as much as 50% or less than the current fishery? The reason I have focused more attention on per seine cost is that early indications suggest that both marked selective fisheries and non-marked selective zone 4 or 5 beach seine fisheries may not return a conservation benefit to salmon or steelhead due to the high handle of steelhead. Little summation, huh?
That's great.
Okay. Basically, the lack of interest in this fishery has decreased over the last 2 years. We had 45 applicants 2 years ago, and then 10 last year, or excuse me, 8 last year for 10 spots. I think the real thing is what happened with the fleet is that they saw what happened to some of the new guys in the 14 experiment, and in 15, they just couldn't see it make it work for them. So that's what you're seeing there. And in conclusion, as an industry, where do we go from here? This coming November is the end of the transition period. Fishermen and their families are in a sort of no man's land. That's not a very good place to be. Thank you.
Thank you. What we're going to do is we're going to have the next panel up. We have one speaker from the public comment that needs to get in and get out, and then we're going to take questions from the commission after both groups and that individual has addressed the commission.
Okay.
The recreational group, Heath Heikela, Jim Martin, Bob Reese, I think I have that right, and Jennifer Stahl.
Okay. Good morning, commissioners. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I've met many of you. Heath Heikela here on behalf of Coastal Conservation Association, both here in the Pacific Northwest for Oregon and Washington. As you know, it's a huge turnout, a lot of interest. Thank you for coming to Vancouver. I grew up on the Lewis River, just up the road from here, and it's a special place, as I think you guys know. I just want to do an overview of what led to this policy. I think it's always good to remember that. First was the need for conservation and selective fisheries. It's not as if you guys just created this move towards selective fisheries 3 years ago. This is where we have been going for over a decade. We have a dozen ESA-listed stocks that come through the Columbia, that pass through the lower river, which requires selective harvest principles in many cases. We have hatchery production that is at severe risk of litigation. Just last week, the department, the NIMS received a 60-day notice on the Mitchell Act hatcheries. That is responsible for 60 million smolt production here in the Columbia, one-third of the entire production. And a lot of these hatcheries are at risk of litigation because of the lack of approved permits and ESA permits, which directly stem to issues with returning hatchery fish getting to the spawning grounds, once again requiring selective harvest to harvest these hatchery fish. And then years of concern about gill netting in the main stem, bycatch, and I think you've heard a lot of that in the past. Another issue was economics, and I think it's important to consider that. It's not the driving, consideration, but it is something to consider. If you look at it on a per-fish basis, a recreational fish is worth 13 times more than the ex-vessel value of a commercially caught fish in the Columbia. If you want to give them a multiplier, which I understand, it'd be about 6 times more. So really this is about optimizing the value of the resource, not about doing away with commercial fishing, because the recreational fishery can't catch all the fish. The other thing, and it's already been covered, is revenue to the agency. 225,000 people, and this is throughout the Columbia Basin. This is not just the lower river. We get really myopic, focused on fisheries below Bonneville Dam, but there is huge demand, and I don't have to tell you guys, growing demand for recreational fisheries in the lower Columbia, in the upper Columbia, in the tributaries, and that is a good thing. We've already gone over some of the revenue figures on the commercial side. The major tenets of the plan, enhanced off-channel areas for the commercial fishery to make up some of those harvests, and we'll get into those numbers, my colleagues will. A main stem priority for the recreational fisheries in light of some of these things we talked about. Selective alternative gear to give access to some of those hatchery fish and also make some commercial economics in the main stem. And then a gill net buyback. So those, to me, were the major tenets of the plan. Concerns, and I emailed the commission earlier this week with kind of my overarching takeaway concerns, and I empathize with the commercial sector on some of these things because there's a lot of uncertainty moving forward on the selective gear in particular, and that is the biggest frustration for me. I think a lot of you know I have been following this very closely for ever since the adoption of this plan, and quite frankly, what's gone on in the selective gear is hard to explain to people like this, where you have have a 2.2% mortality rate, release mortality rate on steelhead, and you have a 32% rate on Chinook. I mean, you had the interim tests on this gear had 1 to 2%. The short-term mortality testing showed a 1 to 2% mortality rate. And then we ended up with mortality rates 30-plus percent. So when there's criticisms that this gear and these fisheries aren't working, it's not because seines don't work. I think Commissioner Kehoe can attest that they work. It's that with those mortality rates, they can't work in the Columbia River where we're limited under ESA impacts, particularly for tules. So that has absolutely got to get fixed. And then, you know, I work really well, try to do with the staff day in and day out. The people here are frustrated as well about things like a buyback. If you came back and you recorded your 2015 check-in, the same slide, the same presentation would have been made about a buyback, about we're coordinating with Oregon on a buyback, and in 3 years, I'm not aware of anything that's been done there. And that's not to say that it is a tool in the toolbox as we move forward here that we need to be looking at, and nothing has been done. So really the question is, where does the department see its future? Is it with the 225-plus people who fish in the Columbia River, provide the revenue, provide the next generation of anglers and conservationists that are going to support resource management in this state? Is it with selective fisheries to maintain our hatchery production, to get our wild fish back to the spawning grounds? So I would just really ask that you work coming out of this meeting. There are a lot of uncertainties. It's going to take some real effort, and I want to let my colleagues here go over some of the real successes with the plan.
I'm sorry, that really doesn't contribute to anybody's points. So if we could just be professional and not emotional on some of this. I know it's a difficult thing to do, but we have a lot to go through, and we appreciate what the emotion is, but thank you.
Good morning. My name is Jennifer Stahl, and my husband and I have owned Northwest Fishing Guides for over 15 years. I'm here to represent ourselves as well as the Northwest Guides and Anglers Association and thousands of sport fishermen. I want to address the crowd behind me with a show of hands. How many people earn their living in the fishing industry? This is both commercial and recreational. My business relies on fishing. We have made our business model primarily focused on the Columbia because of the sport fishing opportunities that are here. And our business makes up over half of our household income. And without this income, I shudder to think where we might be. Our business relies on the communities along the Columbia, from Ilwaco and Chinook to Kathlamet and Kalama, here in Vancouver, up to Stevenson, and even over in Clarkston and Assotin. We rely on the communities for necessities like accommodations, hotels, camping, food, fuel, and of course the oops, I forgot items that we all tend to leave behind. And of course those communities also rely on the income generated by our clients, oops, forgetting what they have needed to bring. We do have clients coming from all over the Northwest region, Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. We also have clients that come from California, Utah, Arizona, Texas. We have our out-of-country clients that come in from Canada. We have out-of-country clients that come from England, as well as Romania. We had clients from Romania that are returning this year. We all forget those items. Those communities rely on the fact that we forget those items. When you take into consideration all the money that are just my guide service of about 500 clients per 7-month calendar year that we have, how much money they spend into these communities, and they're only able to take home one or two fish, and in a lot of cases they take home no fish, this is an extraordinarily valuable on a per fish basis. There is a chart in the handout that you should have received showing that the Lower Columbia River generated roughly $215 in trip expenditures per the WDFW figures. We all know 2015 weather and water conditions were difficult for both commercial and recreational fishermen. It was very evident in the fall coho season, but most of us know from being out on the water for as many years as most of us have been, we can recognize and understand that water conditions are going to most likely drive some runs to come in later. Us as recreational fishermen and guides, we had to rearrange our schedules quite significantly to try and accommodate our clients. We lost a lot of our clients because of that. They cannot change their work schedules to book for their trips. With that said, preliminary data on the 2015 commercial landings for Washington and Oregon gillnet fisheries still exceeded the number modeled in the bi-state plan. This exceeds the commercial X-value vessel in the years immediately prior to the adoption of the plan and is on track to be higher than the baseline X-vessel value model. You've heard all kinds of statistics and numbers. I'm not going to go over those again, but there are some that are very interesting in that packet. Since the bi-state plan's adoption in 2013, key Lower Columbia recreational fisheries are experiencing increased and, in some cases, near record numbers, as you've already heard. In our handout, there is another chart, and this is to refer to the question that was proposed to Guy earlier. We do have another chart in there showing the angler trips and the growth that we've seen over the last few years. To quickly summarize the last few seasons that we had that were so wonderful, the 2015 spring Chinook season saw over 150,000 anglers trips, as you saw on that slide. This is a 40% increase over 2013 and an estimated overall economic value of $9.7 million to the area communities. This is a $2.7 million increase in just 2 years. Summer Chinook shows terrific growth opportunity, as you also have heard from the WDF panel. And we're hoping to expand the season to include July as well as June for not just the buoy 10 typical August dates. Now, this is extremely significant for those of us who did give up the lucrative sturgeon fishery a few years ago. And finally, of course, the buoy 10 season itself saw 108,000 angler trips, which is a 60% increase over 2013. And anybody who sat in a boat launch line can attest to the increase that they saw down there. Our business alone is already booked two-thirds of our buoy 10 season, and the sportsman show season hasn't even started. There is a lot of trips being booked already, and the hotels are already being booked. As Representative Pike touched on earlier, we are able to market those trips as destination trips, and families, not just the dad, are coming for those trips. They are then taking advantage of all of the tourist activities that are afforded in each of those communities and spending more money in those communities instead of just focusing on the fish. We're all here to preserve the resource that we all rely on, and if you throw our hands in the air and say it's not working, none of us are going to have a livelihood left. And I'm not sure about you, but I'm not ready to say, do you want fries with that?
Morning, Chair Smith and Director Unsworth, members of the Commission. My name is Bob Reese. I'm Executive Director for the Association of Northwest Steelheaders. We've got 12 chapters. Our Vancouver President, Greg Robinson, is in the audience today, too. I'm going to reference some of the tables we have here. In particular, promises met. This particular table here shows the dramatic increase upwards of 15 million smolts, about a 45% increase in safe area production from previous numbers. Much of the increased safe production in other parts of the plan have been funded by sport anglers in Oregon. Here in Washington, there were about 226,000 Columbia River endorsement tags sold, generating about $1.67 million in fees. The Oregon Columbia River endorsement revenue from sports anglers has gone to projects that increase production in the safe areas, the test fishing, and creel check, as well as monitoring the commercial fleet. The claims of economic harm by the gillnet fleet are not supported by the facts. While the number of fish harvested in Lower Columbia River fisheries is down this year, largely due to the unexpected decrease in coho numbers, it's still the overall economic value of the commercial harvest is in line with recent years. This particular graph here shows a pretty drastic picture of the value of kept fish. The sport anglers harvesting around 140,000 kept fish, realizing nearly $29 million in revenue, with the commercial catch taking 370,000 out of the main stem with an estimated value of 6.2 million. So we catch a third of the number of the fish for five times the value to the local communities. Revenue to WDFW, you've heard about this before. The license revenue for the department receives from these fisheries. Our members, the recreational anglers, shoulder the lion's share of the burden when it comes to funding WDFW. You've also heard this. 226,000 Columbia River recreational anglers literally generate millions of license dollars in revenue for the department. So members of the Steelheaders and the collective sport fishery groups behind us urge the commission to stay the course on Columbia River reform. I'd just like the sport anglers behind me to simply show a raise of hands for those of us that believe that this commission, as well as the Oregon, should stay the course on this policy shift. Thank you very much.
Chair Smith, Director Ensworth, Commissioners, my name is Jim Martin. I'm a fisheries biologist of 48 years, spent 30 years with ODFW, spent 6 years as chief of fisheries, worked for Governor Kitzhaber, have been involved in these in managing these fisheries for a long, long time, and I'm here representing the hundreds of businesses in the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association. And I'd like to just kind of summarize the four primary reasons why you should stay the course on this plan as it plays its way out, and you should keep your minds open about adaptive management as we learn more and more and more, not just over the next year, but over the next decade. Because one of the reasons why this is so important is because things are becoming more unstable and things are becoming more variable, and we won't always have humongous Chinook runs, and we won't always have unexpected collapses of coho like we had last year. We won't always have warm water that prevents fish from getting into the safe areas. We won't always have cold water either. We're going to have a much, much more flexible management system in the future to take advantage of the hatchery fish where they are, take advantage of the harvestable wild fish where they are, and protect new emerging constraint species, and to deal with the concern about hatchery fish impacts on wild fish. All that's going to create instability. From a management perspective, you really want to have the flexibility to do the kind of adaptive management like the staff did this year, to basically use unused impacts from the sports side to allow the commercials to reach their allocation on spring Chinook, just as one example. Or to use unused impacts from the lower river to enhance fisheries in the upriver and try to balance this whole system out, to try to create the best overall balance of conservation and economics. There's four reasons why this plan is working. The first one is improved economics, and Bob just talked about it, and I won't repeat it. But it's not even close. You can get dueling economists, but it's not even close in terms of the value to the state, the value to the local communities, and your governor clearly knows it in your direction, and you clearly know it in the general impetus of this policy. The second reason is better conservation of non-target fish. The more of the spring Chinook season that is harvested in the safe areas, the less steelhead are impacted in the early part of the year, and it's particularly important in those spring and summer periods. The third one is better funding of your conservation mission. Oregon and Washington get $2.8 million just from the Columbia River endorsements, not even counting the licenses, not even counting the excise taxes, not even counting the tags. You get a total of less than $450,000, both states, from the entire Columbia River gillnet license and tagging. So just think about that. Endorsements are $2.8 million. All the licenses put together from the gillnet fishery are less than $450,000. It's not even close. And the fourth reason is reduced conflict. One of the reasons why this measure has been brought forward, this policy was brought forward by Governor Kitzhaber and supported by the Governor of Washington, is to get rid of decades of conflict that were getting worse and not better. The vast majority of sportsmen and conservationists in this region believe this is the right general strategy for finding balance and mutual support rather than open conflict between sport and commercial fisheries. Remember this, the vast, vast majority of Columbia River salmon are caught in commercial fisheries. Now, the gillnetters just want to talk about their commercial fishery, as if that's the only commercial fishery. But the vast majority of fish are caught in the Alaska troll fish, are caught in the commercial fishery. In British Columbia, are caught in the commercial troll fishery and put on the worldwide salmon market. And off Washington and northern Oregon, heavily caught in the treaty troll fishery and the non-Indian commercial troll fishery, in the lower river gillnet fishery, and in the tribal commercial fishery. If you add all that up, the vast majority of Columbia River salmon are caught in commercial fisheries and are available to the consumers and on the open market. I'd like to just wrap up by saying I think the adventure of figuring out how to use weirs and seines and traps is going to continue for a decade. I don't think it'll be wrapped up by the transition next year. I think the questions that Heath brings up and that all of us as professional fisheries biologists know, there's more questions than answers right now. But even on a year like this year, when we didn't have the coho show up in the safe areas, and when the select area brights didn't go into the safe areas as much as projected, we had extra upriver brights come into zone 4 and 5, and the commercial gillnet fishery was able to take advantage of those and create the value. That's really the strategy we're talking about. This is really the process that leads us down the strategy we're talking about. I have been proud to serve as an advisor to you and the Oregon Commission. I will be proud to continue to participate in the process as we fine-tune the management of these fisheries to be able to meet balancing goals of economics, fairness, and conservation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. What we'd like to do now, we're going to have one gentleman from the audience speak because he has to get going shortly. But when we're done, before we go to commission questions of the two panels, I'd like to have two representatives from the commercial panel and two representatives from the recreational panel standing by to come up and fend questions from the commission.
Sure.
Thank you very much. We have a gentleman in the audience that has a distinguished career, long career in natural resources management. I worked with him when he was a commissioner on the Pacific Salmon Commission, and that's the one and only Larry Cassidy.
It's appropriate to clap at this point.
Good morning. Thank you very much. I got good mic coverage. Okay. First of all, before I get into the comments I want to make, I too, like Liz Pike, would thank you, members, for your service as part of the Fish and Wildlife Commission. Larry didn't mention that I spent 12 years on the then-called Game Commission, now called Fish and Wildlife Commission, so far back that probably a lot of these guys weren't born yet. But in any event, I have sat in the chair that you're sitting in now for 12 years. I was chairman for 4 years. And it's interesting to watch this. It's the first time I've been in front of a commission for a number of years, and the conditions and issues are very similar to what went on. And so I thought, and I thank you for your service. I mean, I realize this is Saturday. You guys could be doing, you men and women could be doing something independent with your personal time, and you've taken this sort of volunteer responsibility to serve the very resource that I prize and have a passion for, and that's the fish and wildlife resources of our state. So thank you. Now, I thought you might be interested in what was the toughest problem I had during my 12 years on the commission and 4 years as chairman. When I got on the commission, I was 33 years old, and the next youngest person was 62. And now that I'm in my 70s, I guess that doesn't sound so bad, but I can tell you it was a very interesting situation at my young age, and for the first couple of years I struggled, but eventually I got the complete support of the fellow commissioners we had, and I became chairman in my third year for 4 more years. And one of the things I realized very quickly, and which I describe as our biggest problem as a commission, was we had great difficulty getting the staff to implement the policies that we passed. Now, you might say, now, wait a minute. We're the Fish and Wildlife Commission. We've passed something. They make it happen. Not always the case. And we had a serious issue with that when I became chairman. And so we started a process that hadn't been done before. We had semi-annual reviews with the director with special emphasis on, are you implementing our policies as we pass them? And I'm sure that Jim's probably not totally excited about that, but it worked pretty well. And it didn't happen overnight that we got the department to implement our policies as we passed. It took about a year. And frankly, a couple of key people went down the road because they weren't getting the message. And eventually we got to where the policies we passed were implemented as we wanted them. And that, to me, is probably the biggest problem we had. We had some other things. I'm most proud of the fact that I was the essential author of the Yakima Trophy fishery for trout. And then also one of the other problems we had was the elk area concept of hunting, where you had to choose the area. We filled audiences all over the state holding public hearings on having to then not just hunt wherever you wanted, but you had to pick the Blue Mountains or the Tyatt and Yakima herd or Western Washington. And eventually we got it done. We had too many people in the Blue Mountains, and it was just not an experience for hunting anymore. So we made a shorter season there, a much longer season in the West, and it worked out fairly well. So I thought you might be interested in the fact that not a lot has changed in all these years. And although your commission is 9 members, ours was 6, and I just think it's doing work. And as far as whether you're getting your policies implemented or not, I have no idea. I am assuming you've got that well in grasp, but I did think you'd be interested in what we experienced. Now, I want to talk to you about a couple, 3 items. First of all, in my experience, and I'm going to talk more about the fish. You've heard a lot of presentations today about addressing the customer base, and I know what that customer base is, and I think it's important, and I'll address that later in my remarks, but my first ones are going to be about fish. But I want to just share one thing that always raises the hackles on the back of my neck, and that's the word adaptive management. And the only thing I would caution you about, which you're probably well aware of, is what is adaptive management? When someone from your staff says that, I've sort of raise my hackles and say, okay, tell me what that means to you exactly, and find out some interesting things sometimes. So it's a dangerous word in my experience, but that's entirely up to you people. The other thing is that I felt it important to mention that a lot of the restaurant table fare for salmon is imported flash-frozen ranch-reared salmon from Chile, Argentina, British Columbia, and other parts outside our area. And not discrediting the commercial fishing industry at all, I'm not opposed to that industry. I think it has a key place in our economic structure, but that's also a key element of what you eat in a restaurant. Now, let's talk about fish for a minute. I think that one of the components that has been mentioned here, maybe briefly by Jim Martin, wild fish escapement is clearly a key component to making these runs better in the Columbia snake system. How do you achieve wild fish escapement? And you people have access to several studies. The one I probably adhere to the most is the Hood River study, which has gone on for, I think, in excess of 20 years, that shows if you match a hatchery female with a hatchery male, you don't get regeneration of the resource for natural spawning on the gravel. Whereas if you match a wild adult with a male with a wild female, you'll get regeneration of the species over the years in natural spawning on a gravel. Well then, how do we get wild fish back up the system? You have to have selective gear in some manner to allow wild fish to be released. And that brings right away to the policy you've already adopted, which says that you are going to take gill nets in some manner away from the fishery in the main stem, and in exchange for that, adding these select areas. I think that your study that was alluded to here today, I believe it's flawed. I think you need a new study. When Larry didn't mention, but I spent 10 years on the Northwest Power and Conservation Council as well, and our budget today, I'm not on it today, but our budget is about $210 million for fish and wildlife recovery up and down the Columbia Snake system, and much of it goes for hatchery production. Well, one of the studies that we funded was the test fishery by the Colvilles in the Okanagan River, where they had 99% survival on seining in the Okanagan River. You have 2% survival noted on your study here, but 20 to 32% on Chinook and 20% on coho. I think your study's wrong. I think you need a new one. You need to really find out what the mortality is on seine fishing in the lower Columbia. And I'm sure you're going to hear the same thing you hear a lot of times. Well, we don't know where we get the funding. We don't know what we do for it. Those are, in my view, minor problems. And we really need to get focused on what you can do with regard to seining and how we can save wild fish in that process and get them up the river. The other thing I talked to you is about hatcheries. I'm not opposed to hatcheries. I think they're a really important element of how this whole Columbia snake system is managed. You have in your state a hatchery called the Clayellum Hatchery. If you haven't visited that facility, and I'm hopeful that you have, it's one of the most state-of-the-art hatcheries in all of North America, but certain for salmon and steelhead. And in that hatchery, you have a system where the operators have mimicked the wild fish experience with their hatchery fish to such a manner that it's just amazing the kind of success they're having in the Yakima. I believe when I went on the council in 1998, we were down to 900 or 1,000 returning adults, spring Chinook adults in the Yakima. We're now averaging, if it's still the same, I haven't looked. I've been off the council for a number of years, but I think it was around 6,000 a year adults, and we had one year it was 22,000 adults. And much of that was a hatchery component that was mimicking the wild experience. I'm not going to go into all the things they do, but I would go to this point. You, if you haven't been there, you need to go there. I'm sure Connie's probably seen it and operated it many times. But it's really worth your trip. It's, and hatchery fish are an important element, but they need to be melded together with the wild fish escape, in which I mentioned earlier. And the last thing I'd mention to you is, and you've had the numbers thrown at you pretty often today with regard to how much revenue is created by this, the recreational fishing industry and taxes and revenues, and what the commercial fishing industry creates as well. I was in the plumbing business all the time that I served public service, and I always took care of my biggest customers first. I didn't ignore any of my customers, and I took care of all of them eventually, but when you've got that kind of disproportionate revenue, I certainly think you need to look hard, and you have adopted a budget policy that does talk about setting policies that are in support of your largest revenue earners. I think that's important, but I also will tell you what's really important, and what I opened my comments with is the fish and the wildlife have to be foremost in your mind, in my view. I used to bound myself on the head when I was in the on the commission and subsequently the power council saying, you know, I got to remember, it's about fish and wildlife. It's not about people always. And if you keep that focus in mind, I think if you keep that in mind, in addition to all these people responsibilities, which are huge, and there's a great crowd of them here today, I think then the trust that we've placed in you, the very important trust to manage this precious resource of fish and wildlife, I think you'll find that you're going to be as successful as you have been and more successful in the future. And I say to you, if you take this trust and you keep it working on the fish and wildlife resource, the people will come, believe me. Thank you very much for this opportunity to come here and talk to you. I'd be happy to answer any questions and talk about anything you'd like.
Thank you, Larry, for all of your expertise, and thank you for your commitment to the state and to our resources. And I think it's very appropriate for a round of applause.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Ben. Appreciate the opportunity.
I do want to... Larry, I'd like to hear more of your thoughts on ways to secure funding. Yeah. Not today,
sure.
Perhaps, because we got to.
No, but I can tell you right off the top of my head, the first place I would go would be the Power Council. Bonneville has a vested interest in getting these wild fish up the system. They're paying the big role with cost with regard to fish and wildlife enhancement. That's where I would start. In fact, I am more than willing to help you in that regard, and probably will do so. I've talked to Guy Norman briefly about the fact that maybe that might be a source of funding. I understand, and I'm not trying to push the envelope away from our state, but I understand Oregon has a little money that might be useful in that process. I don't know the details. We have legislators like Liz Pike and Ann Rivers, who wasn't here today but sent you a letter 2 days ago saying she strongly supports your budget adoption and the fact that you have a letter from the governor of this state saying, yay, team, keep going. This is the right direction. You're doing the right thing. That's a powerful letter. So there are, in my view, many facets under which you could approach additional funding to do a study of that nature. I just don't think those are the impediments you have to say, well, gee, we just can't find the money. Come on. We can make that work.
We'll talk more. Thank you very much. I'd like to have the two recreational reps and two commercial reps come up for a round of questions from the commission, please.
We're an hour behind. Yeah. We're an hour behind. We have 30-some. Okay. He's yelling that way. I'm yelling.
I'm sure you can leave your questions.
You want me to take this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you again, gentlemen. And thank you both for informative and enlightening presentations. We do have, we're running behind time, and I am concern because, again, the 12:30 is a hard time limit. So I'm going to just say if any commissioners have a brief question at this point, because next would be a short break. I know I need a short break. And then we're going to – we have about 30 public comments that we really want to hear. So I want to prioritize that. So, commissioners, do you have any short questions? See, with an intro like that, you can kind of stifle debate. It doesn't work at home, though.
One issue that came up in the presentations I thought I'd just mention is this question about safe area production, and we talked about this, the funding for that. I think we really need to look at the governor's budget, see what's before the legislature. My understanding is the money is actually in there. It was actually wildlife account, not general fund, so maybe that's part of the concern. And if you look at that budget, that supplemental budget request, just to give you a picture, that's a $4 million ask to sustain fishing in Washington. And just an idea, $3.3 million of that comes from the wildlife account, $700 from the general fund. So a lot of that money is coming from license buyers. That's where that wildlife account comes from. But we should look at that production, look at what was promised under the plan, look at what's been funded, because I think that's really important.
Thanks, Heath. Jay?
I guess as much as anything, it's going to be more of a comment than a question. And you mentioned it, and I think Dave will back me up on this. We live upstream. Anytime I want to do logging, I have setbacks. We have water quality issues, all sorts of things. We put a lot of fish into this system. And I know you guys get the first shot at fishing at them, but all of this has a profound effect upon us, too. And we like to fish, too. And it's a huge economic component in our part of the world, too. So, granted, we're talking about main stem Columbia problems here, but they are reflective up in our part of the world, too.
Well, I think the problems do affect you all, and how the fishery is managed down here affects what comes up there in terms of escapement. And I think you're right. I mean, I spent some time in the Met-Tal when ESA listings first happened, and the amount of controversy that was going on there. You all have made a ton of sacrifices in eastern Washington to recover wild salmon, and I think it's important that we maintain public support through fishing to some extent for those efforts. So I agree.
Can I respond to that?
Yes.
Those of us in the commercial industry are supportive of recreational fishermen, too. It's not like we want to eliminate one for our benefit. But in terms of some of those runs, the only place that we can operate is below Bonneville. In the summer season, where a lot of fish are bound for the upper Washington tributaries, our catch last year was 4,000 out of a harvest of a run of 127,000, not a very big component. Even under the pre-policy guidelines, our catch would have been 6,000. So it isn't like we're asking for a large share of that run, and the other fisheries aren't actually harvesting that increased share anyway. So we're just looking for a portion of it to share with all the people in the state. That's our interest, not trying to remove sports fisheries from any of these runs.
Thank you. I would love to do this all day, but we are running up against the wall here. So why don't we take a 10-minute break now and reconvene about 25 after, and then it'll be the public's turn to come up here.
Thank you.
Better.
All right, we're not doing strict.
No.
There's that guy, Bill Hunter, reporter of Astoria Port Commission.
So I'm going to have him come up first. Okay.
It is now 10:27.
Yep. Oh.
Take a seat.
So, come on.
Perfect.
Don't mess with the gavel. Before we get into the general public, again, as our policy to have people that are elected in any capacity that wish to speak, come up to speak. And I'd like to invite Commissioner Bill Hunsinger, who's from the Port of Astoria. So, Commissioner Hunsinger.
The good-looking ladies that sit next to you. My name is Bill Hunsinger. I'm a port commissioner, Port of Astoria. I'm here to represent both sides of the issue, the sports fishery and the commercial fishery. And I wanted to draw up a point to you that, according to Bonneville Power, they spent $500 million last year in salmon recovery. Also, 10 to 12 other groups spent $400 million, not quite $1 billion, to get these fish over the dam. That means that fish cost about $10 a piece to get over that dam. I wanted to explain to you that the taxpayer, state tax and federal tax in Oregon, and the federal taxpayers in Washington, because you don't have a tax, are responsible for this. And everybody that turns on the light in the Northwest is a stakeholder, because they're the ones that pay back the Bonneville Power money in their power rates. So these fish, I don't believe, should be allocated to 10%. I'm not as good looking as that gal either. I don't understand much of a chance, but I don't believe that 10% of the public should be entitled to these kind of 30% for the commercial, 70% this. I don't think they did divide it up, because all of these fish, excuse me, are the state, belong to the stakeholders of these communities all the way to Idaho. So that's an awful lot of money that each one of us pay the consumer who wants to buy them in a seafood restaurant or in a seafood place to take home to cook. And when I listen to a statement made here about farm fish, if you guys want to eat drug-infested farm fish with steroids in it, go ahead. But the Columbia River has the best fish there is. We've got the largest salmon run, and a king salmon run in the world. But anyway, I want to say that both the sports and the commercials come to our meeting. And they're not totally, they're not saying, you know, we need all this fish, because they say we're fishing all the time. And I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but I do represent both sides. I'm also the guy that's putting together the Sea Lion Committee for the states of Oregon and Washington. I belong to both advisory groups. And we're going to meet together for the first time in history to talk about predation. So I'm the committee head to put the committee together, which I think we got to pay attention to what's going on. Well, the sports guy will be standing here, the commercial guy will be standing here, we'll be looking down at the last salmon, and the sea lion's going to swim through and take it. So we got to pay attention to that too. But it's a big economic impact to the people I represent in Clatsop County. And I certainly thank you for your time, but remember, the stakeholders that pay all the money, it belongs to everybody. It doesn't belong to one user group. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. I will call you up again two at a time, and I appreciate brevity. And again, if you want to pass because the person in front of you said exactly what you were going to say, that's appreciated as well. So Lyle Cabe and Bryce Devine, please.
Chairman Smith, commissioners, Director Unsworth, Deputy Director, thank you for being here in Vancouver. We appreciate a lot. I'm a nearly 70-year-old resident of Vancouver and Washington, fished and hunted since my youth, and Columbia River is my home water, and I've been spending thousands of dollars out there looking for a fish or two. A lot of my thunder has been taken by some other people, so I'll crunch this down where I can. But soon after Governor Gregoire was elected, I sent her a letter that asked for the recreational fisheries, the economic priority, and that the gill nets be curtailed because of the high mortality rates and of the fish. Years later, another governor took this concept, ran with it, and both this commission and Oregon's commission boldly accepted the priorities of that. The main purpose of this policy is the fish. Larry very clearly stated that it's got to be the fish, and the primary purpose is to eliminate non-selective, high mortality rate gill nets off the lower river. That is, it kind of gets lost in the economics that throwing around here, like, you know, the safe areas, there were half a million pounds of salmon taken out of the safe areas last year. They can work. Maybe they need some more work on them and more development, but they can work. I'm a little bit the seine fishery. That is slow to develop. The mortality rate on that is just inconceivably high, and I think Larry alluded to that too. But change doesn't come easy. There's always adversity with it. Change hurts, but this is the right change at the right for the right reasons. Economies have already seen the improvements. Nearly $30 million in the economy is going on there. So I would urge you to stay the course, turn this back into a world-class fishery, and help the people of this state to enjoy that. In conclusion, I appreciate your time and your efforts on this and all the other issues that you deal with throughout the year. So thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Brad Halverson, please. And Bryce.
Good morning, commissioners. Chair Brad Smith. Chair Smith, my name is Bryce Devine. I'm a commercial fisherman. I'm also a member of the commercial advisory panel. And my purpose here today is to explain to you what my experience has been through these 3 years of the transition as compared to the three previous years. I'm starting out with the transition years. I'm starting out with the comparison of run strengths in comparison to the pre-plan years of 2010, 2011, and 2012 as compared to the 2013, 14, and 15, which are the plan years. And this time we saw the largest dam passages of fall Chinook since 1938 in the plan years. Bonneville Dam fall Chinook count total for 3 years from 2010 through 2012 totaled for those 3 years 1,219,702 Chinook. 2013 through 2015, the total fall passage at Bonneville Dam was 2,762,934. That's over twice as many Chinook in these plan years. The escapement goal is 60,000 per year at Menary Dam. The 2010 through 2012 escapement was 534,373. That's three times the escapement goal in the pre-plan. And during the plan years, 2013 through 2015, there was 1,364,746 passed over McNary Dam. That's 7.5 times the escapement goal, which is 180,000 for the 3 years. The difference in spring and summer Chinook at Bonneville Dam was not so stark. Totals for the plan years which is 13, 14, and 15, was 491,980 springers compared to 569,659 in the pre-plan. Summer Chinook, and this is based on counts from June 1st, because that was a table that I found under the Bonneville fish counts, was 364,566 for plan years and 287,546 for the pre-plan years. 2015 had a record return of summer Chinook not seen since 1960, and the spring Chinook run was the fourth largest on record since 1980. I guess what I'm trying to say here is that the rising tide lifts all boats. That's the reason for the results that we had. Now, my results compared to pre-plan, my total income for the plan years, 2013, 14, and 15, was 158% of the 3 years previous. My total from the select areas, however, was only 71% of the pre-plan years. The select area income made up 25% of my total income pre-plan and 11% in the plan years. The reason for these results is that the opportunity was in the main stem on these record runs, and that's where I went. We witnessed the largest gillnet harvest since at least the 1980s for fall Chinook. A gillnet harvest in 2015 totaled 6% of the run. Am I out of time? Okay, well, I have more, but thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Chair Smith, member commissioners.
Excuse me, Brad. Okay. Frank Mayer, please. And I wanted to also say, due to the great number of folks who do want to give testimony, some of you may be waiting for item 11. The commission has decided to put that into a briefing later for us, so we will not be addressing the a briefing on the river sturgeon, on lower Columbia River sturgeon. Just simply, we ran out of time given all of this. So I'm sorry, Brad.
Sure. Chair Smith, commission members, for the record, my name is Brad Halverson. I reside in Hillsboro, Oregon. I'm a lifetime member of Northwest Steelheaders, and I'm a lifetime member of CCA. I'm here today to urge your continued support of policy C-3620 and the harvest reform protocols listed in it. 2016 is bound to be a noisy year for this discussion, as both sides present arguments either for or against its execution. It's also the year designated for adaptive management, and both sides will do their best to influence potential adaptations. In light of that, I wish to account a conversation I had last year with a retired Columbia River gillnetter that demonstrates their questionable reliance on income derived from Columbia River harvest. Prior to submitting my testimony at a public hearing in Warrenton, Oregon, regarding the proposed LNG export terminal to be located on the delta between the Skipanon River and Young's Bay, I had the opportunity to converse with a retired gillnetter residing in Warrenton. Because of the increasing importance of off-channel stocking and harvest for commercial interest as a result of this bi-state plan, I expressed the hope that at least on this single issue of a massive terminal impacting Young's Bay habitat and fish stocks, that both commercial and sports fishing constituencies could find some common ground. His response is relevant to your deliberations as you evaluate the noise that you are sure to hear regarding ex-vessel values as a result of using selective harvest gear. He stated that he personally is against the terminal because he is retired and a resident of Warrenton. However, his active constituents had already aligned themselves with Oregon LNG's proposal. My incredulity was piqued, and I reminded him of the significance that particular off-channel zone will have to their future potential. In fact, in Jim Wells' own words today, this is their best select area, their most productive. He said they were promised fiscal paybacks if they supported the terminal in the form of new gear and other financial stimulants. Evidently, these were more important to them than the now sure to be diminished revenue from this off-channel fishery would be by allowing such a project. An attentive person can therefore infer that income derived from main stem and or off-channel Columbia River harvest may not be as essential to their livelihood as they suggest if they're willing to so easily trade it for new gear in, quote, their best off-channel area. Thank you.
Thank you, Brad. And I want to point of clarification that while we will not have a briefing on sturgeon, the public comments will be continued. So if you've signed up to present on item number 11, we were happy to hear you.
And the...
Yeah.
I also wanted to say, you know, for the sake of Bryce, for example, he gave us threw a lot of numbers at it, and I just can't absorb those. We have a lot of ways to communicate with the commission. Public input is very important. I always review all the comments, and I would encourage you, you know, with a complicated presentation, that you forward it to the commission so that we can review that through that process.
And the sturgeon presentation is available on our website. So what we would be seeing today is available there. And what Commissioner Grable said as well, you can feel free to send us emails. So thank you, Brad. And let me call up Harry Barber, please. And Frank?
Thank you very much for your time, and in particular for your service to the residents of our two great states, and in particular the wildlife of our two states, as Mr. Cassidy said earlier. I'll be very brief. I fully support the Commission's plan and urge you to implement the plan in a timely way, and that includes the elimination of gill nets. We all know that they're non-selective killers. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Ed Wickersham, please. And Harry?
Good morning. My name is Harry Barber from Coastal Conservation Association. Thanks for the opportunity to talk today. My message is one of conservation, and I have talked to you before about concerns over stress on sturgeon as a result of the gillnet fisheries. Washington endorsed the Oregon Conservation Sturgeon Conservation Plan, and in that plan, there are several references to studies that show that stress from either commercial or recreational interactions with sturgeon can result in high stress levels or high cortisol levels and inhibit spawning. Playtime is a factor. The longer a fish is on line or the longer a fish is in the net, the more stress it encounters, and the higher the chance that spawning success will be decreased. Brute-sized sturgeon population has suffered from these conditions over the years. As for the commercial fisheries, gillnets cannot discriminate between... Gillnets cannot exclude sturgeon, so the handle of brood sturgeon continues unabated in the target commercial fisheries. I'd like to give you a few statistics. In the Observer study in 2012 for the August and fall gillnet fishery, Hugh and Hollowitz estimated that they handled 2,095 steelhead, 3,400 sublegal sturgeon, 1,100 legal sturgeon, and 747 oversized sturgeon. I'm particularly concerned about the oversized sturgeon handle. The overall health of the sturgeon population is deteriorated dramatically in the last few years, and my position is we shouldn't even be touching these oversized fish. The 660 precious oversized sturgeon were handled, and we don't know if there's any long-term mortality. We do know the stress levels are up, and we have no good data as to what happens in terms of spawning success. In that fishery, there were 1,751 landings in 2015. That equates to about 10,000 drifts between the Lewis and Beacon Rock of gillnets up to 1,500 feet long. Without observers and proper sampling protocols, we just don't know what's going on. So I would encourage the commission to demand intensive monitoring on those fisheries, and I support implementation of the continued implementation of the plan. And I thank you for your efforts.
Thank you, Harry. Ken Marfin, please. Ed Wickersham.
Good morning. Chairman Smith, Commissioners, Director Unsworth. My name is Ed Wickersham. I reside here in Clark County. I've been a member of the Columbia River Angler Board since the inception of the legislation. I'm here representing CCA Washington and the Clark Skamania Fly Fishers. I'll just, you've heard the business on the endorsement, but I think it's worth saying again, 225,000 recreational anglers bought $1.6 million worth of endorsements last year. That's more than the actual ex-vessel value of the catch of Washington commercial fisheries on the Lower Columbia River. We keep hearing the claim about the commercial fishery on the Lower Columbia River, the non-tribal commercial fishery, provides food to the consumers. Well, let's take a little closer look at that. They dismiss the fact that the tribal commercial fishery on the Columbia River takes 2 to 3 times more fish than the non-tribal commercial sector. Some would argue that if you look at the data over time, it may very well be that the tribal or the commercial fishery on the Columbia River should probably rest with tribal nations. Regarding who provides fish to the non-fishers, another point I would offer is that I think that maybe recreational fishers put more salmon and steelhead on the tables of our citizens along the Columbia River than anyone else. I want to thank the Commission for their adoption of the Columbia River Fisheries Reform Policy and ask that you ensure it is implemented on time by 2017. And something that's been kind of overlooked this morning, except Harry touched on it, let's not forget these gill nets are non-selective, they have huge bycatch, and they're killing a lot of endangered fish, and there's no way to get around it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wickersham. Mark Hellriggs, please, and Kent.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Kent Martin. I'm a lifetime commercial fisherman from Skamakaway, Washington. One of the justifications for the Columbia River Management Plan was a supposed conservation value. Well, I was there, and I can tell you that was debunked in the work group process prior to implementation. But I've always contended the plan is a conservation negative for two reasons. Number one, the huge hatchery and natural spawn surpluses created by restrictions on the commercial fishery. And two, perhaps more importantly, the highly suspect hooking and handling mortalities assigned to the sport fishery, especially during times of elevated water conditions during the summer and fall. I say suspect because the only definitive study of recreational hooking and handling on the Lower Columbia is the 2-decades-old study of the Willamette River Spring Chinook in 42-degree water. The study assigned an 11.1% mortality rate, but for some reason it was rounded down to 10% on the main stem. The mortalities for summer and fall warmer water temperatures are based on litter reviews and guesstimates based on extrapolations. The June 2015 transaction of the American Fisheries Society published an extensive study of pre-spawn mortalities of hooked and released sockeye on the Fraser River in British Columbia. The assigned pre-spawn hooking and handling mortality came out to 35% in 59-degree water, with disproportionate incidence of females. Now, I'd be the first to note that the Fraser is a different river from the Columbia, and the study was done on sockeye, not Chinook and Coho. However, Columbia River seine pre-spawn mortalities for Chinook and Coho range from 21 to 38% in 68 to 70-degree water. My contention with the conservation negative is that the plan currently assigns 70% of the hooking and handling mortalities of listed salmonids to the sport fishery, and the same data suggests that those sport mortalities may very well be much higher than are currently used. My question here then is, where's the science in all this? Finally, I want to bring up something I keep hearing about how valuable the sport fishery is relative to the commercial fishery. This ignores the fact that you have to remove 10 fish from our fishery to put one into the sport fishery. The other 9 end up as hatchery or natural spawn surpluses. And the fact is there are economic costs related to all those surplus fish in the form of spilled water, fish food, et cetera, that are not being counted in on the against the value of the sport fishery. Thank you.
Thank you, Kent. Thomas DeLuck, please. I'm sorry about your names. If you were all named Smith, I'd get it all right. Mark?
First, I'd like to thank the Commission, Director, for your service and for this opportunity to speak
before you today. My name is Mark Heirigs, and I represent the 260 members of the Clark's Commandant of Fly Fishers as their conservation chair. I am also a concerned recreational angler. I have issues with gill nets in the Columbia River. I have set nets. I have cleared nets of floating debris. I have picked gill nets in Alaska. Gill nets are effective, non-selective, and lethal. When the net is lifted over the skiff's bow, it is as if there are bowling pins sticking in the net. Instead of dead wood, they're dead fish. Not once while picking a net have I had to fight a live fish to throw it to the bottom of the skiff. If they get caught in the net, they're dead. Both commercial and recreational fisheries must be selective. The non-selective characteristic of gill nets is negatively impacting our Columbia River's sturgeon population, the upriver B-run steelhead, our locally ESA-listed species, and summer chinook. Although unlisted, wild summer chinook have not recently met DFW's escapement goals in a number of upstream tributaries. I'd like to share an example of selective recreational angling. This summer, some friends and I went for a day of fishing on the Columbia River and caught three wild chinook. The magnificent fish were brought to the boat, netted, inspected for an adipose fin, unhooked in the landing net, revived until they appeared strong and released no worse for the wear. This would never happen in the non-tribal commercial fishery. Gill nets are non-selective, deadly, and need to be removed from the Columbia River. I would like to encourage the Commission to immediately implement non-tribal commercial gill net reform. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, sir. Gary Loomis, please. And Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's Dulcich, and in Croatia, it's Dulcich, but when they came through Ellis Island, it became Dulcich. It doesn't look anything like it's spelled like. It doesn't sound like it. I don't spell it more than 20 times a day on the phone. So I am not offended. Here's my personal story. Growing up in the North Oregon coast, there were limited opportunities. The opportunities I had were washing dishes in a commercial fish plant in Igigik, Alaska, E-G-E-G-I-K, if you want to look it up, and pulling nets in my dad's boat on the Columbia River. I haven't heard a word here today about the young people in Pacific County, in Wakayakum County, in Clatsop County, in Columbia County. Will those young people have the opportunities provided for them to better themselves that I did? My belief is if you remove the time-tested, effective tool of gill nets from the main stem Columbia and you continue to push the allocations instead of a fair 50-50 into 80-20, those next generation of young people in those rural communities where there is no Boeing, there is no Intel, there's not even a Hanford, won't have the opportunities. And I ask you to please carefully consider those opportunities. I have other things to say, three actually. Number one's the boogeyman. Number two is the ownership mentality, and number three are the tribes. The boogeyman is the gill net. The gill net, a well-managed, careful gill net fishery like your staff and the Oregon staff and the Columbia River Compact have managed on the Columbia River for over a century, is effective. How do we know it's effective? Because the last 3 years, fall chinook returns to the Columbia River have been the three highest since 1938. So if these nets are supposedly non-selective fish killers, how is that possible? It's a boogeyman, and it is false. Mr. Chair, may I?
Quickly.
Ownership mentality. Will you manage the resource for the 1 to 10% of us just like me who like to sport fish, or for the 80 or 90% that consume salmon? Most of the people in Oregon, Washington can't afford to do what we're doing here today, or to spend $150 or $200 to go on a guided fish trip, but they can spend $10 to $20 for a piece of salmon at the market. The tribes have been the stewards of this resource for thousands of years, longer than any of our European ancestors even knew there was a North America. And the tribes have been consistently against the Kitzhaber plan. I ask you to take that into account as you think about how this should be going forward.
Thank you. I'll just say thank you, Thomas, without getting into the last name now. David Brown, please. From here, you can see if you can do. Mr. Loomis.
Yeah, thank you. I'm Gary Loomis, CCA. 2 years ago, I was invited up to down to Chile to fish for the new Chinook salmon run that was in Chile. These fish were put in Chile 1950, 51, 52, and 53 in two of the rivers from eggs from the Columbia River. 2 years ago, two of us went down. We found the fishing absolutely fantastic. And in turn, we went down the following year, last year, three of us, in 7 days of fishing, we caught 119 Chinook salmon. 5% of them were below 20 pounds. 5% of them were between 20 and 35. 90% of them were between 35. Our scales only went to 70. So somewhere in that, 90% of them. We had more 40 and 50-pound fish, and that is from the genetics from the Columbia River. What's the difference? It took 65 years for these fish in the rivers in Chile to be able to increase the numbers, because the nutrients in the upper watershed weren't as good. They had to get more fish spawning, and the run is now is doing this. Last year, there was three of us that went down. 50 people showed up. We have over 500 people going down this year. Folks, we're losing the capital of the salmon fishing of the world here in the Columbia River. This thing could be absolutely fantastic. It could fuel all of the commercial fishermen. This is about gill nets. If you run the fish through the gill nets for 150 years, you get exactly what we have, 12, 13, 14, 15-pound fish. You, the board, how many of you are close to 6 foot tall? Quite a few of you. If we'd have killed everybody five generations ago over 6 foot tall, there'd only be two or three of you left. True or not true? So it'd be a little bit of rough like me here. But you guys wouldn't be here, and that's why our 50-pound fish aren't here, because we run them through a gill net. We kill the big ones. We use the little ones for the brood stock year after year after year. We're killing our threatened and endangered fish. Thank you very much, and thank you for what you guys do on the board.
Thank you, Gary.
We're looking for David F., and I can't pronounce the last name, from Battleground. Are you here? David F. something. You're not here.
Okay. Then we'll move on to Michael Sertzinger, please. And also Ross Barkhurst, please. And don't kill off all the big guys yet, okay? That's it. Michael, yes, thank you, sir.
Michael Seitzinger, Clark County. I'll be brief. I do want to encourage support of the plan as proposed in the implementation in January of 17. I think Representative Pike and the panel that spoke in favor of pretty much covered all the points I had. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Michael. Steve Cushing, please. Is it Cushing? I'm going to give it to my interpreter.
Steve Cushing from Hawkinson, Washington, representing CSFF. It says I support the plan as written.
Just hold on one moment. We got it.
Okay.
Don Kohler.
My comments have already been.
Thank you, sir. Rick, are you doing this intentionally to me today?
Washak from Astoria.
Okay. So, Ross, I got you.
Thank you. Good morning, commissioners and directors. I'm Ross Barkhurst from South Bend. I fished the Lower Columbia River from St. Helens on down through Bowie 10, and I do cross the bar periodically since 1973. If I hadn't spent 10 years participating in the Cold War, you could add 10 more years on the front end of that. I share the first gentleman's revulsion for the term adaptive management. My main question today would be adapting to what? The presentation had a lot of data, but it was completely devoid of the E word. I never heard the word escapement. Maybe we're not proud of our escapement. If we have still 12 to 13 ESA listed fish in this Columbia drainage, and we don't talk about escapement, then there must be a problem. Two or three years of a phase-out program has not got us there yet. The Bowie 10 fishery, as some of the folks showed, the even in a great year, the numbers are not going up. The reason they're not going up is because we allot X percent to the non-selective gill nets above Bowie 10. And September 1st, when there's still Chinook around, the fishing is cut off. There aren't that many people that are going to drive in more boat and so forth for a 6-pound silver. And a lot of them are shrinking, too. Caught 16 to 20 inch silvers the last couple of years with eggs in them. Not a good sign. No matter what else we achieve, there's not going to be a greater Bowie 10 fishery. It's getting crowded because we've created a big bubble in front of Young's Bay to help out that fishery. So we need to stay the course. We have to phase out non-selective harvest. And if we don't, with the end of a good cool cycle in the ocean, the last 3 years are the best years we'll ever see. Thank you.
Thank you, Ross. William Hunsinger and Rick.
Yeah, my name's Rick Quashnick, and kind of trying to represent my family, which is mostly fishing today, crabbing on the coast. So the Kitzhaber plan has kind of proven that it doesn't work. So we just kind of want to go on record as that we're strongly against the Kitzhaber plan. So I appreciate your guys' time. So that's about all I've got. Make it short. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And so, William, you already spoke, right?
I already spoke.
Okay. Thank you. Nello Pasinich, please. And Randy Woolsey.
Chair Smith, Commissioners, Director Unsworth, thank you for the opportunity here to testify, and thanks for having the meeting down here in Southwest Washington. My name is Nello Pasinich. I'm the Executive Director for CCA Washington. I'll keep my points brief. We've heard some conversations about Eastern Washington, who fishes on the Columbia River. CCA testified earlier this week on the Columbia River endorsement stamp, which is the $8.75 we get to pay to fish the Columbia and its tributaries. I was looking over the data on that this week, and I just wanted to add some stats to some of the comments we've heard here. I thought it was fascinating. 29% of those sold to Washington residents come from Southwest Washington. 38% come from Eastern Washington. And I was astounded at this. About 34%, a little over a third, come from the Puget Sound region. So this issue impacts the entire state, not just the 70,000 recreational fishermen and a couple dozen gillnetters on the lower river. I was also looking over the data in that report, and since its inception has generated about closing in on $10 million. We'll probably reach that $10 million mark here in the next year or so. And that just, you know, served as another reminder how the department is continually looking to the recreational community for some of its funding and its revenue. And I just, on behalf of CCA Washington, want to thank you all for taking a bold stance as we navigate through this new era of fisheries management. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pasinich. Steve Jones, please. And Randy? Yep. I got that one right.
Chair Smith, Commissioners, Director Unsworth, thank you for this time. My name is Randy Woolsey. I am a longtime member of the Columbia River Recreational Fishery Advisory Group for about the last 10 years. One of the pleasures I've had in participating in that group is how the staff that you have helps the recreational anglers and the industry model these fisheries so that we can have consistency in the fishery. That consistency is really what creates a long-term opportunity for recreational anglers to get out on the river, and your staff does a great job of building that toolbox so that we can do all that. One of the things that came up earlier, there was some questions about angler days on the river. There are lots of restraints on the river. I mean, we have restraints with tules in the fisheries. We have restraints with infrastructure, and it's very difficult to double the number of recreational anglers or even a third more when all the boat moorages are filled up. I don't know if you've ever experienced trying to put your boat in Astoria during even before the peak of the run shows up. It can be a two-hour wait before daylight. And if you happen to show up a little bit late, if there's more traffic coming for town, it's, you know, 2 or 3 hours into daylight before you can launch your boat. So that's a restraint that keeps those angler days from really being what they could be in that part of the river and on up the river. From an industry, and I'm a manufacturer's rep in the fishing tackle industry, so I bring a little bit of that perspective. These stores that sell fish and tackle, they have full-time employees, they offer retirement programs, they try to keep those employees, and these stores can't operate like a fireworks stand or a Christmas tree lot. They have to have long opportunities to get their customers on the river, and the department has really done a good job of giving that longer opportunity. So I support everything that the recreational advisory panel that was up here mentioned, and thank you for the time to talk to you.
Thank you, Mr. Woolsey. Liz Hamilton, please. Oh, she left?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Tom Hester and Steve.
Thank you, Chairman Smith, Director Unsworth, Commissioners. Thanks for bringing this hearing to the lower left-hand corner of the state here. I am Steve Jones. I live in Camas. I'm president of the Clark Scamania Fly Fishers. Our 260 members urge you to stay the course on this plan. It is bold and courageous, and I applaud you for taking these steps. And I'd urge you to even go further into more research and continue to explore those more selective gear rules, because indiscriminate harvest is the enemy of the fly fishermen. Our members access these Columbia steelhead and salmon fisheries in the estuaries and the tributary rivers, where we're looking for the biggest and the best, and bycatch is our enemy. And it's the enemy of everyone who's after an endemic species that's migrating, because bycatch is the biggest threat to those upriver components of the fishery. And it's also the biggest threat to the endangered and threatened species. So I'd urge you to continue focusing on selective gear rules. And I'd also bring to Larry Cassidy brought up many issues today. It's important to note that our club was founded in 1975 when Mr. Cassidy sat in the commissioner's seat and was very instrumental in the decision to make the Wind River a native steelhead river. Clark Scamania fought hard for that. Sometimes Mr. Cassidy was our ally. Sometimes he was our enemy in that fight. Some, many of you know, I'm sure. But nonetheless, the conservation forces prevailed. There were fewer than 50 native steelhead. Made it over Shepherd Falls, I believe, in the early 80s. And this past year, there were 663 natives in one of the best wild steelhead fisheries I can remember in my 20 years fishing the Wind. So focusing on selective gear, native fish, and removing all the predatory harvest from a river really works. And the Wind is proof. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Vern Forsberg, please. And Tom?
My name's Tom Hester. I'm with Polson Cascade Tackle. We're a manufacturer in Clackamas, Oregon, that makes fishing products unique to the Pacific Northwest fishery markets. The primary thing I wanted to get across here today was I've heard a lot of communication that the reduction or the fall of the coho fall fishery had a negative economic impact on the commercial fishery. Well, I hold in my hand right here three representatives of product families we build specifically for the fall coho fishery, and since that didn't materialize, that affected us negatively as well from an economic standpoint. So it isn't just a commercial side that takes that blow. We do too. We're sitting on inventory of this stuff that we're going to have to hang on to till the next season and hope that that materializes next year for us as well. Another point I'd like to make, and I didn't originally intend to make this point, but I've heard an awful lot of commentary here today about how 10% of the population are the beneficiaries of the majority of these salmon runs we have in our Columbia River. Well, that tends to imply that there's an inequity there based on only the fishermen themselves deriving benefit from that. Now, I've got employees who are dependent on the sport fishery who do not fish. They don't sport fish whatsoever, but they are still a beneficiary of the sport fishing industry. I've got suppliers, mostly locally. We source most of our products as locally as we can, as often as we can. Many of them do not fish at all, let alone sport fish, yet they are the beneficiaries of the economics of the sport fishing industry. So I would submit that it is a false premise to assume that it's only the sport anglers themselves that are deriving a benefit from the majority of these fishermen, these fishing activities. It affects a lot of people upstream as well as downstream of my manufacturing process, right down to the sheet metal suppliers that we have in Clackamas, Oregon, the wire form suppliers we have in Linwood, Washington. All of those people, many of them do not sport fish. They do not commercial fish. They do derive benefit from the sport fishing industry. I would urge you to continue with the program that you're on right now and stay the course.
Thank you, Mr. Hester. And Vern Fosberg was not out there. Okay. John Anderson and Mike Backman, please. And because you have all done so well, we have time to go into the back to the schedule as original. So we will have the sturgeon briefing, and then I have the time for the comments from those of you that wish to comment on the sturgeon briefing. So, John.
Thank you, commissioners, for coming to my part of the state. I'm a resident here in Clark County, businessman. For the last 10 years at the port of Camas, Washougal. Our company is called Foods in Season. We purchase, one of the items we purchase is the salmon from the gillnetters on the lower Columbia River. At this time, we have 40 employees. We have an investment of over $3 million in our business. The port has an investment of close to $6,000 to $7,000 in buildings they put on their property for us to facilitate our business. Not only over the last 10 years we've been buying from the lower river gillnetters, we've formed partnerships. We've tried to raise the value of the fish as it comes off the boat. By doing that, we've asked our fishermen to put ice on their boats to keep the quality up, which has worked great. As we heard, the price was $2.50 a pound average for fall salmon last year. That's a significant increase over the previous year of around $1.60, $1.75, because we started this, other companies asked their fishermen to put ice on their boat. We're raising the quality of the product to the end user. We would like to see this fishery continue for the reason the Seine fishery is a bust. I've purchased fish from the Seine fishery the last 2 years. Let me tell you what you get off the Seine fishery. You get fish about that big. That's king salmon. They throw all the URBs over because it's a select fishery, so it has to have their fin cut off. You get a bunch of tulies because they swim next to the bank. That's the weaker fish. The bigger, stronger fish, the URBs, are at the bottom of the river where it's cold, the water is swifter, and they're headed up the river. I would like to contend that it's not $10 a fish that the BPA has invested in these fish. It is closer to $250 per fish. I can get the documentation for it if you'd like to see it. It's from their own stats. So who is paying this $250 per fish? Anyone that flips the light switch on in the Northwest. So I am adamantly opposed to removing the gillnetters from this river and putting them in basically ditches in the states, which have not proven to be a value fishery at all. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Backman.
Hi, I'm Mike Backman. I'm here to represent, I didn't come up earlier, I'm a county commissioner, but I didn't come up here as a county commissioner, I came up here as a commercial fisherman. I do represent both. The thing of it is that we do appreciate when people come sport fish in our community, but that isn't the whole story. They leave, they come, they spend a little money, and they leave. When people go fishing in Cathlamet, we have a high percentage of commercial fishermen in our community. They spend money all year, and it's important that they know that they both need to coexist for our county to be able to exist. We want to talk about making it about fish. When we're talking, it's about selective fisheries. I don't know how somebody sold you a bridge. I don't know how you can say that a hook can tell a wild fish from a non-wild fish. These guys are fishing. You don't have any real-time data saying what was caught. You know, they say, well, we're not catching them, but you see thousands of people say they had the best fish they ever caught, most fish they ever caught, and at the same time, you call these fish endangered. Endangered means you get to catch all you want, because now we don't count. We're not paying attention to the real number. You have the technology to get a real report every day. I buy fish. I'm a Columbia River fish buyer. You know where we caught the fish, how many fish we caught, how many fishermen took part in that fishery every day. By 10 o'clock the next morning, you know exactly. So we can't go over it. There's no, oh, we accidentally caught too many fish. We fished. You know exactly what the number is. You're able to monitor what's going on a real-time basis. You have nothing for that. You have no classification. You have no classes on how to handle fish. The guy says, I revived my fish. He didn't take any class. You didn't offer any classes on how to revive fish. Every one of us gill netters have a card that says that we took a class that showed us how to revive a fish to tell when you can release the fish after you handled the fish. You have no restrictions. You have endangered species. What do you have to handle? What do you have to have to handle endangered species? $50, which goes back to your 19% of the fish and wildlife budget, which should be in the general fund, shouldn't be in the fish and wildlife budget. It should go to the general fund, and then the general fund funds your department, not so-called ownership. When 19% of your budget comes in from them, fine, you get 19%. But that's not the true cost. The true cost is more like 80% of your budget. So you're running at a deficit, taking care of them, acting like they did you a favor, giving you 19%, when it costs you a lot more than 19% to actually run all the different types of fishery, between trout, salmon, lakes, you name it. You're talking about going to select fisheries, but yet you took fish out of the select fisheries and put them in a lake. Last year's coho, you didn't put in deep river. After we had the best season ever in deep river, you took and didn't put fish back in there, knowing that this board's supposed to say that you're going to support putting us in there. You couldn't pull some trout money or some other money that you didn't put a priority to make it work. You don't have the flexibility or the will to make this work. It's just lip service, and I'm sorry, but you call it as I see it.
Thank you, sir. That concludes the public comment for that item, and we will move into item number 11, and hopefully then, and we have some public comment on item number 11 as well. Yes.
Mr. Chair, I don't know. I know we're tight on time.
It's a judgment call. I mean, it's one or the other. So I have about six public comments here. And we have 55 minutes, or 65 minutes. So. Oh. Bill Shorten there. Okay. Let's do that then. Okay. So. So, I will quiet the room. Or did you just want to talk? You want to address them as well? Okay.
Yeah.
If you are exiting, could you do so quietly and quickly, please? We're going to take 10 minutes for the commission just to ask some questions generally and have some dialogue about the comments that you have all provided. So we'll do that for about 10 minutes and then go into a short and sturgeon briefing with then public comments on sturgeon. So I'll let Commissioner Keough kick it off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to take a lot of time, but I mean, this is a very important issue, obviously. And we've heard a lot about the term adaptive management, and that's a big part of this policy. And if I may, Mr. Chair, I think I need to read, and of course we're all going, this is our Constitution. This is the guiding principles that we have agreed to. I know people would like to discard it. I don't think that's productive at this point. I know the commission is not have the appetite to revisit many of the issues. But there is an important part of this policy, and I'm just going to read from the policy for the record, if I may. And this is under the general policy statement. There is uncertainty in this presumptive path forward, including the development and implementation of alternative selective fishing gear, securing funding for enhanced hatchery production, and the expansion or development of off-channel fishing areas. Consequently, the Commission recognizes that management decisions in this transitional period and subsequent years must be informed by fishery monitoring, biological and economic, and may be modified as necessary to meet the stated purpose of this policy. So, you know, as I look at this, and I wasn't around for the adoption of this policy, but clearly one of the linchpins of this was the development of an effective selective fishery on the main stem, one that presumptively could have impacts on non-targeted wild species of as low as 2%. We don't have that today. And not to blame anyone, I think, you know, we've heard comments, well, the study is faulty design. Well, I think that's a little bit of Monday morning quarterbacking, if you ask me. But in any event, we're stuck with these very, very high impact rates. And NOAA fisheries will not allow us to go any lower than that. That's what we have. We're talking about maybe another study. Larry Carpenter, who I know and respect very much, says, oh, yeah, you can get the money, no problem. I mean, we're looking at probably the study that we had was several million dollars. So, you know, I intend, as we move forward in this progress, to make sure that the commission meant what it said when it said that we were going to do adaptive management. And to me, with this, the big one, and there are others, buybacks, development of off-channel areas, I don't see that that a lot of these presumptions that we had when this policy was put into effect are coming to fruition. So under the policy, that means that we make changes or we do something differently than the path that's forward. I don't know. We're not ready to do that today, but I would urge our commission to work along with the Oregon Commission. It's not just on this side of the river. It's on the Oregon side of the river. So I just wanted to let the public hear that, and that's my perspective. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Other commissioners' comments? Oh, sure. Yes.
Well, go ahead and let Connie go first.
Okay.
I'm going to greatly shorten my presentation here. You've filled some of the gaps there, and we've heard much this afternoon, but I'd like to refer you first just to one policy that the department has that's a commission policy, which is entitled Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife Hatchery and Fishery Reform. It was signed in November of 2009, and it is the basis of our participation and the philosophy, the science philosophy behind our participation in the Lower Columbia River Plan. I'm not going to read some of the I was going to read some of the excerpts from it, but I'll allow you to find it. It's policy C3619, and it outlines what our policy is with regard to hatcheries. And our hatchery policy is way out in front of everybody else when it comes to genetic protection of our natural stocks and the potential interaction with hatchery fish. And you heard Mr. Cassidy this morning calling for the need to recover wild spawning populations, and that's the basis of that policy. I'm going to skip over a bunch of stuff here. A note, to succeed in our policies, we require the separation or isolation of natural and hatchery origin populations on the spawning grounds and can be achieved in several ways. Those several ways are marked selective fisheries. But, you know, in my estimation, none of this is possible until we correct the unnaturally high release mortality information rates rates that are imposed on our fisheries as a result of recent studies. And I've heard that repeatedly today, and I agree with that. Scientists that I have talked to raise their eyebrows when and are very skeptical on the data and are calling for new experimental plans to repeat the release mortality study. I think we have to do that. My personal opinion is that we should proceed with the Columbia River fishery management policy. We need to stay the course, as I've heard the comment today, with the following, perhaps with the following suggestions. I think that the department needs to provide the commission an experimental plan to redesign the mortality study and seek appropriate funding as rapidly as possible. I know it's in the works, and I'd like to see an acceleration of that. We need to move aggressively to mark selective fisheries, commercial fisheries, and I don't think we can do that unless we have a redesigned mortality study. Additionally, I'm concerned also with low participation in the selective fisheries trials. And in order to encourage participation in marked selective fisheries, I would like to see maybe such innovative things as reassigning some of the commercial fishery impacts to favor the alternative gillnet fleet. Or the alternate purse seine fleet. And finally, I would like to see the commission provided within about 30 days a draft of the buyback program. We have been sitting and waiting for a buyback program for 3 years on this commission, and each and every year there's a reason that we don't do it. I don't see that we really have any reason to wait anymore for a buyback program. I understand that buyback programs can be complex, but give us a draft for crying out loud. Let the commission see what the department is thinking with regard to a buyback program. I have some other comments, but I think I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Do you want to let Larry go? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Macon usually takes a lot of my thunder. It takes most of my 9 pages away down to a half a page now. But I want us going to go back to the development of this policy and the process. And I guess it was an interesting process. It took a lot of time. We had a lot of meetings. We had a lot of great people volunteer time, both from the Washington and Oregon sector. And there were so many discussions, pros and cons, do this, do that, let's modify this. None of us had a crystal ball. None of us knew precisely what was going to happen. But I think the policy, generally speaking, is very, very sound and appropriately mixed with our primary goal, which is conservation. But one thing that I think is critical, and we are going to have a very severe problem shortly with hatchery fish straying, if we can't figure out a way to remove them from the watershed. And I've heard it a number of times from Bob Turner that if we continue to have too many hatchery fish mixing with wild fish, the federal government will reduce the productivity of hatchery fish. So then where are any of us? So whether you like seining, you don't like seining, it is going to have to become involved in harvest in the Columbia River. Last comment, adaptive management. I said it this morning in an early fish committee meeting. It's an important item to have in there. It's no doubt we need adaptive management. But like I said in the meeting, and I truly believe this, adaptive management doesn't give you a 36-inch pipe wrench to make adjustments. It gives you a small screwdriver to test those adjustments, make sure you're going the right direction before you crank it over too hard.
Commissioner Thornburg.
I just want to echo the comments of my fellow commissioners. Commissioner Kehoe pointed out the portion of the policy that he read, and it is of concern to me that we still have uncertainties in areas that were identified as uncertainties when the policy was written. I too want to see this policy go forward and aggressive movement toward a selective fishery. And to do that, we're going to have to get this seine net situation straightened out. So I would like to just propose an idea that I take. I work more commonly in the agricultural communities, and I'm used to seeing conservation programs promoted with farmers and ranchers. And there we use financial incentives. And so I just might offer a suggestion of perhaps financial incentives. As we've heard repeatedly, change is difficult, and sometimes financial incentives help with that kind of change. So that might be something. I know we have financial issues, but that might be something that we want to take a look at.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any further comments, questions from the Commission? Okay, seeing none, we will then. There was a good dialogue, and thank you, Commissioner Keogh, for raising that time to do this. This is